opportunity to stop and get all the insider gossip about traitors. No spoilers, I promise. And the second is, I just spotted that story about Elon Musk securing a $1 trillion deal to continue running Tesla. And I don't know how many noughts there are in a trillion. Don't text me, because my inbox will become completely cluttered. But I'll find out and tell you, if you, like me, don't already know, after the news headlines. But we begin with two of the biggest institutions in this country, possibly the two biggest, or the two most important, and baked-in racism.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock. Pressure is increasing on Andrew Mountbatten Windsor to comply with a US investigation into Jeffrey Epstein. A Congress committee has requested that he gives evidence over his friendship with the late sex offender. Cabinet Minister Steve Reid told LBC earlier that Andrew should seriously consider the request, while the Shadow Minister Claire Coutinho also thinks he should take part.
I think this situation has been incredibly sad and, you know, awful for victims, of course. Imagine all of these things that they must be seeing. I think he would be wise to cooperate. Obviously, that's his decision. He's not compelled to, but I think considering everything that's happened, he would be wise to cooperate with any investigations.
The US committee doesn't have the power to compel Andrew to appear, and he denies any wrongdoing. A review has found anti-black racism is baked into the Metropolitan Police's HR systems. It's concluded the Met's leadership, governance and culture are producing racial harm. Scotland Yard says it recognises the scale of the challenges. Three prisoners have been charged with the murder of a fellow inmate at Wakefield Prison in West Yorkshire. Kyle Bevan, who murdered his partner's two-year-old daughter, was found dead in his cell on Wednesday. Searches are continuing for an Algerian sex offender who was mistakenly released from HMP Wandsworth. It emerged on Tuesday that Brahim Kador Sharif was released in error last Wednesday. The Prime Minister has promised to step up and fix the justice system after a number of mistaken releases in recent weeks. ITV has confirmed it's in early discussions to sell its media and entertainment arm to Sky. If a deal is agreed, the division would be worth up to £1.6 billion. And Tesla shareholders have approved a record-breaking pay package for their boss Elon Musk, which could be worth $1 trillion. The unprecedented deal drew huge applause at the firm's annual meeting overnight. The deal depends on the world's richest man meeting certain performance goals over the next decade. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was down 50 at 96.85. The pound buys $1.30 and €1.13. LBC weather, sunshine and showers will move across the UK throughout today. And another mild day, a high of 16 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Chase is the digital bank you can count on.
How so?
Because you get 1% cash back on your grocery shop.
Like on prosciutto?
Yeah, prosciutto.
And seaweed crackers?
Sure, those two.
Hang on, what about rotisserie chickens?
If it's in your grocery shop, Chase has got your cash back. Join today and get 1% cash back on debit card spending on groceries, fuel and everyday transport. Chase, see what your money can do. 18 plus UK residents eligibility applies. 1% cash back for your first year. Maximum £15 per month. Exceptions apply.
This is LBC from Global. Leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
It's 3 minutes after 10 and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC, where the answer to the question that I posed a moment ago, and despite me asking you, importuning even you not to text me with your answers, many of you did, some incorrectly. The answer, what am I going to do now? I'm going to be all sniffy about people who I think have got it wrong, and then it'll turn out they got it right and I got it wrong, and I'll look like a wombat. 12 zeros in a trillion. I'd quite like to talk about that, but I'm not quite sure how to. It's not just the vulgarity of it, the obscenity of it, the idea that anybody is worth that sort of money, essentially for selling cars. but what it says about our society, but also the impunity that man enjoys. the way that you can be filmed doing Nazi salutes, you can incite race riots on the streets of the United Kingdom, you can tell absolutely unparalleled racist lies about a country you know nothing at all about. You can champion serial criminals who do nothing but spread lies and division in our midst. You can do all of these things. You can use your money to put a man found to have incited an insurrection in his own country by his own Congress back into the White House. The list of things you can do if you are rich enough without any pushback, punishment or consequence is, I would argue this morning, I would argue that it's infinite. It's infinite, or at least there are a trillion ways in which you could demonstrate that once you achieve a certain level of wealth, you can do whatever you want. Jeffrey Epstein thought that he could, of course, but I guess in some ways perhaps he wasn't wealthy enough. I don't know what the phone-in would be about this, but it feels like a very sad moment. I don't know how much history you've got, for example. There were no barons more powerful or richer than Henry VIII, and if there were, he'd just turn up on a Tuesday and ask for their house. Isn't that how he got hold of Hampton Court? Wasn't Hampton Court built for somebody else? And Henry VIII just turned up one day and said, "Oh, nice house you got there. Be a shame if something happened to it." And they decided one of the Thomases, almost certainly one of the Thomases, I forget which one, Cranmer, Cromwell, Moore, Thomas someone, Seymour, I don't know. Speaking of Seymour, there's a story in the news today about the descendants of the brother of Jane Seymour, still living in a house that they had for 400 years. But remember that if David Lammy gets promoted to a big job in the cabinet, then according to Dominic Cummings, who's become the latest self-styled brain of Brexit to out himself as a purveyor of absolutely 100% proof racism, then it's evidence of unfair overpromotion. Says the son-in-law of an aristocrat. I think it was Woolsey. Was it Woolsey at Hampton Court? Let me read you a message from Jim, because this is, it moves directly to the heart of what I want to talk about. It's not Musk, unless you can come up with a brilliant question about Elon Musk, and you can text it to 84850, or indeed WhatsApp it to 03456060973, then I will, well, I won't pay you, obviously, but you will earn my eternal gratitude if you come up with a really good way into this question. What, I toyed with the idea of doing the 10-year game. You know, you look at poverty in the world, you look at what we thought about Nazism and fascism 10 years ago, you look at what we thought we knew about ourselves and our own societies. How would you explain to someone who'd just woken up from a 10-year coma, how somebody who is a executor of Nazi salutes and a disseminator of terrible, terrible racist lies can be cheered to the rafters and offered a $1 trillion pay deal in a country that used to style itself as a great defender, a bastion of freedoms, a country where the current president was found to have incited an insurrection against an absolutely unchallengeable election result. The complete collapse of all the things that we once held dear seems to me to be distilled down this morning into a $1 trillion. Listen, he's not going to make $1 trillion unless he sells a gazillion cars. And at the moment, Tesla isn't exactly covering itself in glory for a whole bunch of reasons. But the idea that that's somehow just normal and getting waved through, it just fascinates me. But anyway, Jim's been in touch. Jim, definitely not a racist, by the way. He writes, "You did very well this morning, James. You managed to get 5 sentences out before the word racism was injected. Isn't it all a bit tired now, mate?" And it occurred to me that Jim won't be alone. There will be, in fact, should we play the history game with Jim? I may have a little look at the history of the text that he sent to the programme in a moment, just to get an indication of exactly where he's coming from. Because there are 2 stories in the news today, or in the news this week. One is looking at the Metropolitan Police and the, once again, inalienable evidence that anti-black discrimination is systemic. This looks at leadership, governance, culture, and concludes that racial harm was maintained through a repeated institutional sequence, to which Jim's response is, "So what? They're black. Tell them to get over it. Get the chip off their shoulder. Stop playing the race card." Wes Streeting, who Jim may pay a little bit of attention to because he is white, Wes Streeting reported this week that racism in the NHS has become, worse than ever. It's become close to endemic, and it includes not just patients abusing the people trying to care for them and look after them, but it includes colleagues and managers as well. The thing that has shocked me most of all, he said, is the rising tide of racism and the way in which kind of 1970s and 1980s style racism, of course, that's what Jim refers to as the good old days, has apparently become permissible again in this country. And of course, you would expect racists like Jim to be delighted about this, but they're still not. There's still a sense of people not wanting to talk about it because it would involve clocking themselves in the mirror and recognising somebody who would be quite happy to join in with it, and is increasingly likely to do so. This is the thing I find fascinating. And I don't know, and it's a bit like Elon Musk's Nazi salutes, things that would not have been countenanced even 2 years ago, 3, 4, 5, 10 years ago, things that we would not even have had debates about, we find people today falling into the trap of having debates about whether what Sarah Pochin, the reform politician, said about adverts was racist. Spoiler alert, of course it was. Whether what Dominic Cummings said on social media last night about David Lammy is racist. Spoiler alert, of course it is. And you catch everybody having debates, really. I know it sometimes makes me sound a bit holier than thou, but it's as if you have swallowed a style guide. We only know how to approach subjects by turning them into debates. What was the other big example? I mean, there have been quite a few absolutely grandstand examples of public racism, which people from the BBC onwards have engaged in, and which have debates about whether or not it is actually racist. So it's not racist to complain about the number of black faces in Handsworth. That was Honest Bob Jenrick, of course. It's not racist to complain about the number of black faces in adverts. That was the Reform UK woman, of course. There's a Conservative councillor who appears to have resigned after posting on Facebook something that is avowedly racist. But, you know, you have to recognise the existence. You have to remember the existence of people like Jim. Because I'm going to tell you a little bit about white privilege now, if I may. I read a text like that from Jim, and a little bit of me, a tiny little bit of me, goes, do you know, maybe we do a little bit too much. I mean, other days I think we don't do anything like enough. Institutional racism being on the rise, this lurch back to 1970s standards of bigotry and viciousness, are, of course, among the topics that you sort of think you should be talking about every day. But, you know, this is a commercial radio station. And if you respond to yet more evidence of societal racism with a shrug or with a roll of the eyes or with a little sense that it is something that's getting too much attention, then you, I think, are... And I, if I find myself harbouring those feelings, I'm demonstrating what white privilege is. It's the kind of thing that says, well, obviously, if it was me that was being discriminated against by the police and the National Health Service, say that again, not just by Jim or by, you know, Billy Buncher numbers on social media, or even perhaps by the richest man in the world. If I was being, if I lived in a country where the two institutions designed to protect my health and to protect my safety were becoming petri dishes of weapons-grade racism, I would find that very, very important. But, of course, if you're not in the catchment area, if you're not in the crosshairs, if you're not from an ethnic minority, then you don't care as much because you're not being targeted. And listen, that's not a criticism. If I punch you in the face, it's going to hurt a lot more than if I punch Keith in the face. However much you love Keith, or let's do it the other way around. If Keith punches me in the face, right, you might be outraged, you might be disgusted, you might be heartbroken on my behalf. But if he punches you in the face, you're going to care even more. You just are, in that moment. It might, as the dust settles, change. And you might think, no, I'm glad you punched me in the face, because that means that James's beautiful features are... untouched. Or I'm glad that you punched me in the face, because he's been punched in the face 10 times already this week. And frankly, that's not fair. So you see what I mean. If you're not in the crosshairs, if you're not in the target area, then you have a different relationship with discrimination, with racism, compared to the people who do. But that's the thing you need to stop and recognise, isn't it? The thing you need to stop and realise is that if you lived in a country, if you paid your taxes in a country, if you had been born in a country, if you are dedicated to this country, if you are free to serve in the armed forces or join the police or work in the NHS in your country, in your home. I was listening to Massive Attack this morning, and sometimes a line just grabs you, doesn't it? It reaches back from 30 years ago and slaps you around the chops. It's a line in the, I forget which track it is, on the first Massive Attack album, Upbringing English, Background Caribbean. And now you've got people in public life who would dispute their right to use the word English in that context, including Suella Braverman. Do you know, listening to Massive Attack back in the early 90s, I don't think it would have entered my head that anybody would ever have a problem with a black British man describing himself as Upbringing English, Background Caribbean. Now you've got former cabinet ministers who've not just got a problem with it, they're making a career out of trumpeting how big a problem they have. If you lived in a country where the institution charged with protecting you was full of discrimination against people like you, and the institution charged with caring for you when you need it most, when you are ill or vulnerable or injured, was a place of increasingly endemic racism, how much would you care? I'm frightened of going to hospital in case I get called. I'm frightened of going to work in a hospital in case I get called the N-word by a patient again. I've been a victim of crime, but I can't really call the police because, well, you know why. And that's why it matters, Jimbo. That's why you have to talk about it, mate. Because that's what human beings do. They recognise the reality of situations and they try and unpick them. But what we can do here, of course, on this programme, what we try to do on a fairly regular basis, is describe that reality to people who are reachable, people who are not actually so far gone down the road to this sort of attitude that they can't be brought back again. And that's what I really want to do. And I'm not sure. Sometimes it doesn't work when I try and knit too much together. Sometimes the wider the goalposts, oddly, it's not like the more likely you are to miss, but the wider the goalposts, the less likely you are to bother taking a shot. Do you see what I mean? Sometimes I go too far, a laser-like focus. Yesterday's show, I thought it was brilliant, but there's a danger when you ask something as specific as how do prisoners get released from prison early? Only call me if you know. Only call me if you've been in that chain of command. Happily, with the first call notwithstanding, happily it worked very, very well. But it might not have done. Do you see what I mean? Sometimes I focus, we zone in together on a question so acute and so specific that you are really potentially setting yourself up for a bit of a disaster. And of course, at the other end of that extremity, the other end of that is when you ask a question that is too big. So give me a call and tell me about racism in the NHS and racism in the Metropolitan Police can be a little bit too broad. So you sort of think, oh, I don't need to. And oddly enough, that's when I end up getting hung out to dry. So I'm going to put the NHS story to one side for now, because it broke earlier in the week. We talked about it a bit when it did. And I'm going to turn your attention instead to the racial harm that the Metropolitan Police inflicts on black people being institutionally defended. And it is about the leadership and the culture within the Metropolitan Police protecting the force from real change. This is an internal review published today, drawing on internal documents and evidence. And the Met has responded by accepting long-standing evidence of racism and discrimination within the force. And what the rest of us need to do is work out, I think, two things. The first is, what we mean by institutional. It's a word that the current Metropolitan Commissioner, Sir Mark Rowley, has refused to use. He refuses to use the word institutional. He has explained himself, and it is not a difficult position to understand. He thinks that if you describe the Metropolitan Police as institutionally racist, then everybody in it will feel that they are being labelled as racist, to which my response would be, well, explain what it actually means, then, which is what I'm going to ask you to do. What is it? 0345 6060 973 is the number you need. What is the difference between someone shouting racist abuse in a canteen or on a street corner or at a colleague and institutionally defended racism? I want you to tell me that, okay? Hit the numbers now, you will get through. 0345 6060 973. The difference, if you like, between bad apples and a rotten barrel. So, I have on occasion been required to work with racists, but I have never had to work for a racist organisation. I have never had to work for an institutionally racist organisation. So I can highlight pretty much what the difference is. The difference between a bad apple and a rotten barrel. And you might think, no, you can't, James, because if you're working with people who are racist, then you're working for a racist institution. But I'm not, you see. Because there are plenty of people in the Metropolitan Police who are not racist, but there is an institutional problem with defending racism. Describe that to me. 0345 6060 973. If you can, the difference, the definition, the meaning of the word institutional. I think that's probably our starting point, actually. I don't know that we need anything else this morning. Except, of course, for a question that I think you can probably only answer if you're on the receiving end of this sort of behaviour. What does it do to you to know that your treatment by, reception from, the Metropolitan Police will be different from mine? And Jim's, Jim the racist, it will be different from mine because I'm white. How does it change your relationship with the police when you know that they are institutionally racist? So I want to work on what the word institutional means in this context. Everyone can have a crack at that, but you probably need to be part of the target groups to answer the second question. What does it do? Tell me. Tell me how your reaction to the word police, the institution police, the meaning, how is it going to be different from mine because of what you know, what we all know, but which some people, like Jim, are either very keen to deny or to pretend doesn't matter. 22 minutes after 10 is the time. Hit the numbers now, you will get through.
LBC.
We all want to live well and age well. That means having independence and positive choices to enjoy the life you choose. That's what Thrive Living at Botanical Place in West Byfleet is all about. A place of fun, a friendship, in a hive of activity. But above all, it's a supportive community that puts your independence and well-being first. With offers available on apartments to buy and rent, visit the marketing suite or book an appointment at botanicalplace.co.uk.
It's another day at Screwfix, and Sir Mo Farah is still getting to grips with things.
So, Mo, with Sprint Delivery, we get the order to them in as little as 20 minutes. Mo?
Mo?
Done. He was on the 18th floor.
Nice work. But, you know we use delivery riders, right?
Oh, now you tell me.
Sprint it in as little as 20 minutes. Screwfix. No stopping you. Conditions and geographical restrictions apply.
Nothing beats a Jet 2 holiday. Exploring the sun-kissed scenery in Costa de la Luz. Soaking up the authentic Spanish culture. Bathing on beaches. And wandering timeless whitewashed towns. Get next summer sorted. Book now and take your pick of our best rooms, flights and hotels. Plus, spread the cost with flexible monthly payments. Jet 2 holidays. Package holidays you can trust. After natural protected. Subject to availability and conditions.
This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
23 minutes after 10 is the time, and I don't know that we will ever know will we, what it feels like to be on the receiving end of institutional racism. You can tell Sam points out that that's what two-tier policing means. And, of course, what racists like to do is pretend that the white people, people like me, are somehow more likely to be mistreated or unfairly received by the police than people of colour. I mean, all of the evidence pushes the other way. But I guess if the sight of black faces on the streets of Birmingham or brown faces on television adverts disturbs you or drives you mad or makes you wish you lived somewhere else, then it's probably quite easy to persuade you that actually that the institutionally racist police is institutionally racist against white people. Madness. Absolute bloody madness. But that's Brexit Britain for you. Babs is in Stratford. Babs, what made you pick up the phone?
Hello. So I work in Stratford. I was working for a borough in Stratford. I experienced institutional racism and had 5 weeks off sick because of it. I reported it to my managers over and over again. I explained there was a racial element to this and it was ignored. I had to leave that job and go, because I desperately need the money, I took up another job within that same borough. And there are 9 employees, 5 of us are, 4 of us are black, 3 of us are all sick at the moment because of institutional racism. It's inherent in the system. I won't obviously name the borough.
No, I
was taken to court last year for racism.
Okay, well, the more detail you give me, the more careful I will have to be about examining your story without offering up a right of reply. And I'm happy I'm happy to do either, but bear with me for a moment because I want you to bear 2 things in mind. The first is, in a moment, I'm going to ask you to explain to someone very sceptical about everything you've just said, what we mean by institutional racism. Because I know what racism is. Everybody knows what that is. You turn up at work and someone uses a racial slur against you. That's not institutional racism. What makes it institutional is what happens next. So that's the first thing that I'm going to ask you. Or the second thing that I'm going to ask you. The first thing I'm going to ask you is, I'm going to presume that you take time off sick because the situation is unbearable.
Unbearable. Yeah.
Okay. So let's do the second question. What is the institutional bit of your experience?
The institutional bit is that as I raised it, I know that...
Raised what?
As I raised that there's a racial element as to how I'm being treated.
I don't want to be like a prosecution barrister, but if I was, I'd ask you to describe the behaviour that you are referring to, or what actually happened.
So I was left out of meetings. I was left out of meetings. I wasn't included on documents. But I was aware that also, I suppose it's also intersectionality in that certain areas where other black people weren't able to be attacked, and I will use that word attacked, it was aimed at me because of being a lower grade. But I was aware that this same behaviour was going on with other black people within the organisation.
So there would be
situations
that your status would qualify you to be included in that you were not included in, and when you look for reasons why, the only one that really presents itself is your ethnicity.
Yes, it was just me in those particular, but other aspects that have happened where other black people were ignored or left out or certain treatment, but were of a higher management grade. So the other dynamics came into it as well.
And what makes it institutional is what happens when you point it out and complain.
When I pointed it out, and when I also found out after what happened to me that this particular behaviour is apparent within the council.
It's funny, isn't it? Because you might hear, or I might see, I'll check in a moment, people being still sceptical about this, or people claiming that you're playing the race card or that you've got a chip on your shoulder. And yet they will be the same people that gallop to the defence of public figures who complain about black people having the audacity to appear in adverts, or too many adverts, or too many people on the streets of Handsworth, or, you know, you can't be British, or you can't really be English. So they actually demonstrate the existence of the racism you describe, the institutional racism that you describe, because the people I've just referred to haven't been cautioned or disciplined by their employers, in this case, the Reform Party and the Conservative Party, but they will be sceptical of you. So with one hand, they prove that institutional racism exists by defending the examples of institutional racism within the institutions that they like, in this case, the Reform Party and the Conservative Party. And in the other hand, on the other hand, in a different breath, in the next breath, they deny that it exists anywhere, including your workplace, of which they have no experience whatsoever.
Exactly that. I mean, they're saying that it's not representative of what they see as the face of their country. Mm. But then I know that I'm not represented within my workforce.
Yes, I don't know. I mean, I get it. And I don't know how it ends, because the Metropolitan Police have been dealing with this conclusion, this evidence, since the McPherson report came in the aftermath of Stephen Lawrence's racist murder. And yet they're still here. It's still baked in. Racial harm still inflicted on black people and being institutionally defended, which is exactly what Babs has just described. And it's not, you see, this is the point that I needed someone like Babs to help me fully appreciate. It's not about shouting the N-word at people in the office or in the workplace. It's about treating people differently. And a lot of these guys won't even know that they're doing it sometimes. That's, I think, what we mean by institutional. It's like watching an advert and being driven mad by the number of black faces, like genuinely being driven mad, and not realising that even if you feel that way, you don't say it out loud. How do you think it makes other people feel? Sorry, I'm not allowed to be in an advert now because I'm black. And not only that, but it drives you mad, Sarah Poachin? It drives you mad? And then the boss comes along, in this case Nigel Farage, and sort of defends it. So if you really didn't know, or you really needed help to understand what institutional racism looks like, there you go. There's a brilliant example. It begins with someone doing racism, having racist impulses, seeing a black face on the television and being, quotes, driven mad by it, or seeing lots of black faces on the television and being, quote, driven mad by it. And it then gets compounded and rendered institutional by the system in which you work and possibly the broader society in which you operate, condoning it, or at least refusing to condemn it, excusing it, or indeed endorsing it. And that's when it becomes institutional. Thank you, Babs. Dominic Ellis has your headlines.
A cabinet minister has told LBC that Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor should go and help the US Congress if he can. Democrats have written to the former prince requesting an interview over his links to Jeffrey Epstein. A report has concluded discrimination against black people is baked into the culture and leadership of Britain's biggest police force. The internal review has called for structural change at the Metropolitan Police. And Thomas Tuchel has recalled Jude Bellingham and Phil Foden to his squad for England's World Cup qualifiers next week. There's also a first call-up for uncapped Bournemouth midfielder Alex Scott. LBC weather, sunshine and showers moving across the UK today. Another mild day as well, a high of 16 degrees.
LBC.
It's finally happened. I found it.
Found what?
The perfect mini. And it's part of the mini stock event.
The what now?
The mini stock event. Unmissable savings on in-stock models on top of existing offers. But I've got to move fast because when it's gone, it's gone.
Go get it, pal.
The mini stock event. Unmissable offers 6th to the 10th of November at your local mini retailer. Available on new mini stock orders placed during the stock event and registered by 31st of December 2025. Visit mini.co.uk/stock event.
Have you noticed the way fans shout at football matches?
Oh, wake up!
That's because conveying your message with sound is the most effective way to communicate to the players on the pitch that they're rubbish. And this works in advertising too. You see, research shows how brands that use radio to amplify their advertising are 49% more likely to get noticed. See radio differently at radiocentre.org.
Great to see you back at Specsavers. Okay, could you read out the letters on the wall for me?
Yep. D-E-A-L-S? Yeah, D-E-A-L-S. Deals.
Oh, right. Our Black Friday deals are eye-catching, but the letter chart's over here.
Oh, sorry.
At Specsavers, we've got all sorts of unmissable Black Friday deals, like up to £50 off one pair of designer glasses. Offer ends on 7th of December 2025. Conditions apply. Ask in store for details.
Now, let me ask y'all a question. Are you ready to ditch the crowds and the cookie-cutter holidays? I'm talking quiet mornings spent by crystal-clear lakes, cruising across the vast landscapes of Canada and the U.S. at a leisurely pace, stopping at charming towns and saying howdy. Go deeper with littleamerica.co.uk.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345
6060 973. 10:34 is the time. So here's a thought. I'm trying to work out, and I hope this doesn't sound as if we're trivial. I know it doesn't. Shut up. Work out at which point racism becomes institutional. It's a really important question. And actually a really interesting one, because when does society become institutionally racist? We are a far from perfect society, but compared to other countries in recent decades, we've done very well in this field. I know that a white man saying that will be uncomfortable to some people, because I am not on the receiving end of the horrors that remain and the unfairness and the bigotries and the racism that remains. But obviously, since 2016, we've gone into reverse in a lot of ways, since the sort of racist genie was let back out of the bottle by Nigel Farage and others. And it's interesting how the people who would once pretend to be disgusted by his bigotries, of course, you know, most obviously, I suppose, unveiling that Breaking Point poster on the morning that Joe Cox was assassinated by a racist terrorist, the people that pretended to be perturbed by that are now pretty much embracing the same sort of impulses. I'm thinking of Daniel Hannan. I'm thinking of Dominic Cummings. I'm thinking of Douglas Carswell, all of the sort of self-styled intellectuals who would once perhaps have pretended that they found Farage's ignorant nativism offensive or unpleasant. They're moving into that space now. And then you think of the other recent examples. You think of Katie Lamb wanting to deport people who had every right to be here because of cultural coherence. You think of that Sarah Poaching woman being driven mad by seeing black faces in adverts. Speaking of black actors, I saw David Harewood's Othello on Tuesday night at the Haymarket Theatre. I've seen two shows this week, and it's hard to think of two shows that can both be brilliant and yet be more different. I wonder if you can guess what the other one is that I saw last night. I'll tell you later, but David Harewood's Othello. I mean, it's so timely. It's heartbreaking. It's so on the money about the issues that we are dealing with now that perhaps we thought we'd put to bed. Or at least put to sleep 10, 15, 20 years ago. Absolutely extraordinary performance. And Toby Jones, who can do no wrong, can he, professionally speaking at the moment? He is Iago. Iago is the second biggest part that Shakespeare wrote. Certainly for men. I don't know whether Cleopatra might challenge this, but Hamlet has the most lines. And Iago, despite not being the title character, has the second highest number of lines that Shakespeare wrote. But if you want to see magic, if you want to see genius on the London stage, go and see David Harewood and Toby Jones in Othello at the Haymarket. And listen, I know it's expensive, and I'm not going to criticise you for reminding me how expensive it is, because it is part of the conversation. I wonder if you can guess what the show I saw at the other end of the seriousness scale is that was absolutely brilliant, one of the best things I've ever seen on the London stage. I saw it last night. I'll give you a clue. I was with my 17-year-old, and for much of the show, for much of the duration of the show, she was seven. She was 7 years old. But we're talking about society. And when does society become institutionally racist? So Katie Lamb, absolutely unchallenged over her racism by her own institutions. I think they gave her Newcomer of the Year at the Spectator Awards, where I believe Robert Jenrick also got an award. Robert Jenrick, the man who doesn't want to live in a country where there are people who don't look like him on the streets. When does that sort of racism become institutional? Answer, when it's not properly challenged. And you've got the media not challenging it, and you've got their own employers not challenging it. Less surprisingly, of course, would be someone in Nigel Farage's latest party, in this case the woman driven mad by black faces in adverts. But again, that's the danger. When were we last an institutionally racist society? Most obvious answer to that would be when signs saying no dogs, no blacks, no Irish were commonplace in boarding house windows. Are we an institutionally racist society now? I would say no, but that could be white privilege. I would also say we are heading in that direction because of public figures not being held to account for their racism. And then, of course, you get the columnists, who probably also won awards at the Spectator Awards, like Rod Liddell and Richard Littlejohn, who are so quick, like little hair triggers, to condemn anybody who accuses anybody else of racism, even when it's obviously racist. And they're fascinating and very, very important parts of the process of institutionalizing racism. And they're Jim. They're Jim's people. So Jim doesn't like conversations about this because they make him feel a bit uncomfortable. Jim, spoiler alert, mate, they make us all feel uncomfortable. This is Hannan recently. We keep being told that the perpetrators of the Huntingdon abomination are British-born. Okay, so were the killers at Woolwich Barracks, Southport, Tavistock Square, Westminster Bridge, Manchester Arena, London Bridge, etc., etc. The alleged perpetrators, given the legal situation at the moment. If you insist on denying that this has anything to do with immigration policy, I'm afraid you're not arguing in good faith. So again, if you don't look like Daniel Hannan, then you are part of a problem and you are to be conflated with convicted and proven criminals. And you know, there's a word for that. And the word I would use is racism. So is that institutionalised? He's still on the pages of the Daily Mail every day. Oh, and by the way, he's not British born. I don't know whether that's pertinent to somebody who is condemning people for their action. He's not British-born. He was born in Peru. And he has dedicated his entire life to trying to undo all of the positive PR that Paddington Bear has managed to achieve for people who come here from Peru. 10:41 is the time. Frederick's in Westminster. What's institutional about it, Frederick?
I would say that an institutional racist, or an institutional racist, a racist institution is by definition without an individual racist actor still leading to racist outcomes. So if I have a cultural difference, there's much more likely for a misunderstanding to happen and therefore things to escalate and then, some kind of arrest, for example, with the police or in the case of the last caller. I wouldn't have said that the individual is a case of institutional racism, as in they're just being racist, but the, as you say, what comes next, that's where we can really look into what it means to be institutionally racist.
So you either don't see it or you minimise it, or because it's possible that some of the people Babs is talking about, if you told them that what they were doing was racist. So, like Dominic Cummings last night, David Lammy tweeted that he was proud to be the first black person to answer Prime Minister's questions. And that's an extraordinary achievement for people who are, for people who are British. It's something to celebrate for all of us. He had a bit of a nightmare at PMQs, which is something that we also should acknowledge. But in the first instance, the historic significance of that moment dwarfs the poor elements of his performance. Dominic Cummings chooses to greet this moment directly by describing Lammy as the logical conclusion of what he puts in quote marks, multiculturalism and DEI politics. A useless, writes Dominic Cummings, and then a word I can't say on the radio, humiliating the country, the commons, and quotes again, black people, end quotes. If he were assistant manager in JD Sports, the 18-year-old staff would say, overpromoted, and then a word I can't say on the radio, get rid of him. This is a man who, of course, eased Boris Johnson's passage into Downing Street and subsequently put people like Dominic Raab and Nadine Dorries in the cabinet. So he's an absolute expert on meritocracy and deserved promotions. If Labour keep putting him up, they will destroy themselves even faster. Don't believe me? Put that video in focus groups with swing voters outside London and see what they say. Here's a perfect symbol of how our pathological institutions have destroyed confidence. I mean, it can't really read anymore. Dominic Cummings has clearly gone mad. But and taken a few moments off from sifting through bins to go and express his bile on social media. But what we're all saying is the unwitting nature of the institutionalised stuff. So him not even realising that the sight of a successful black man boils his blood so completely, he has to attribute it to over-promotion or diversity initiatives. He doesn't even know that what he's doing on an individual level is racist. And therefore, if ideas like that infiltrate an entire institution, the institution becomes racist.
That's right. It's just decades-old racism that he's employing there. And if he wants to keep the status quo or go back to how things were when there was so much more racism in the day-to-day and people didn't have the opportunities and the economy was worse because there are less people making more successes, it just doesn't make sense to me. It's completely and utterly ridiculous.
Well, yes, but of course it's also rather dangerous when you have people in positions of prominence, and Dominic Cummings is unlikely to assume one of those. In fact, you know, a quick word on what overpromotion looks like and whatever the opposite of meritocracy looks like. And there's a payoff to this that's quite extraordinary. Thank you, Frederick. The single most greased passage to prominence in this country for people who are supremely unqualified to have any status in public life or public discourse goes like this, okay? You go to private school, and then you go to a good university, and then you go to work for a secretly funded think tank. And then maybe you do a little bit of work for an organ that walks hand in hand with the secretly funded think tanks. Most obviously in this country, The Spectator, which is now owned by the man who set up GB News. And he's got a couple of other organs that employ people who couldn't get arrested in an objectively meritocratic media, but who can land amazing jobs in the institutions that are owned by him, where Nigel Farage, of course, on GBBS has his own show to spread his party political propaganda. So these are not people who are being promoted because of talent. They're being promoted because they are useful idiots for wealth, for the billionaires or the very rich people that run these organizations. So that this is the most reliable path to prominence if you are not very talented but desperate to be important in the political media ecosystem in this country, okay? Almost as soon as you come out of university, you go to work for a secretly funded think tank where you start slagging off things like climate change and the BBC or state intervention in commerce, regulation, red tape, rules. In Dominic Cummings' case, there was a little bit of a window before he did that where he went to Russia and did things that people aren't quite clear about. He helped set up an airline, apparently, or something like that. He comes back, secretly funded think tank. That didn't really kick off, gets a job at The Spectator. And then lo and behold, he's advising Michael Gove, who now edits The Spectator, and then Boris Johnson, who becomes Prime Minister, and Dominic Cummings is standing behind the throne while we witness the single most incompetent and corrupt administration that this country has ever seen. But if you are born with that sense of impunity and entitlement, then you don't take any responsibility for that whatsoever. You don't really feel any guilt or shame, not on the surface. It's eating you up from the inside. Your empty soul produces only bitterness, and somehow that becomes a handmaiden for racism. You find me an insanely privileged straight white man in this country whose life has gone down the tubes, whose professional life has gone south, who has failed utterly to achieve any of the things that he thought he should achieve. And in Dominic Cummings' case, of course, he can smell how close he came to being the person that he always thought he was. And we can smell the person that he really is. And it stinks to high heaven. But then he sees a black man. He sees a black man at the dispatch box at PMQs and he hates it. He hates it. He hates it so much. I don't know where the drink had been taken, but he hates it so much that he piles onto social media to start accusing David Lammy of somehow owing his status, his success, his job to multiculturalism and DEI politics. You hear people claiming that someone of colour has only got their job because of DEI politics. They're waving a massive great flag saying, I am doing racism. But they can't see it. That's when it becomes institutional. Dominic Cummings handed every possible gift that our society can bestow upon a mediocre intellect, and he blew it all. He torched it all. He fluffed it all up. He put Boris Johnson in Downing Street and presided over vomit-strewn corridors full of carousing and canoodling incompetence while we couldn't even go to our own grandmother's funerals because of the rules he'd introduced and then rode roughshod over to drive his own child to Barnard Castle for giggles and kicks while claiming that he was testing his eyesight. This man, this hideous, hideous creature having the audacity to preside over corruption and incompetence, the likes of which this country had never seen even close to Downing Street, now sees David Lammy at the dispatch box and can't contain his racist fury. He'll probably get a job on The Spectator tomorrow.
This is LBC.
So, what's on your to-do list today? Why don't you check if you're eligible for pension credit? It tops up your pension income and also opens up help with heating bills, council tax, and more. Search pension credit on gov.uk or call 0800 99 1234. There's nothing to lose. Check today. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
Buying a home on a holiday park was the retreat you always wanted. But then came unexpected site fee increases. And that was before the dramatic loss in value. If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, you may have been missold. HolidayParkAdviceCentre.co.uk could help you receive thousands in compensation. Text ASSIST to 78900. That's ASSIST to 78900.
At Laithwaite's, we go to great lengths to bring you great wine. We go far and wide, searching high, and we mean really high, and low, and we mean stored deep underground in a cave low. Off the shelf, we don't go there. Off the beaten track, we certainly go there. And the best bit is, we even come to you. Order now at laithwaites.co.uk. Laithwaite's. We stop at nothing to bring you great wine.
Great to see you back at Specsavers. Okay, could you read out the letters on the wall for me?
Yep. D-E-A-L-S? D-E-A-L-S. Deals.
Oh, right. Our Black Friday deals are eye-catching, but the letter chart's over here.
Oh, sorry.
At Specsavers, we've got all sorts of unmissable Black Friday deals, like up to £50 off one pair of designer glasses. Offer ends on 7th of December 2025. Conditions apply. Ask in store for details.
At TfL, we're helping make roads safer. We're continuing to roll out lower speed limits because 20 miles per hour roads have already seen 24% fewer collisions causing death or serious injury. We're also improving junctions to help keep you safe, and improving visibility for our bus drivers with new wing mirror cameras. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Comparison of collisions data before and after implementation of 20 miles per hour speed limit.
James O'Brien on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
10:52 is the time. This is timely from Fabio. Let me read this in its entirety. I can understand that initially, if you hear your workplace is institutionally racist, you could go on the defensive because you, yourself, or your colleagues are not. But it's a bit like if your town doesn't flood from climate change, you shouldn't believe that climate change isn't real and that things shouldn't be done to address it. It's nothing harder than criticism of something you hold dear, like your job as an NHS worker or a police officer, but there is no quicker or better way of fixing these problems than accepting that they are real and they do need change. Fabio goes on, Eddie Marsan gave a great interview the other day and something really stuck out at the end. Although he was talking about acting, I think it's relevant to this. Exercise in empathy. And if there's one thing that we need more of at the moment, it's that. If you can empathize with those experiencing something that you're not, and then help fix those problems, then that is the only way to fix things. By complete coincidence, Eddie's in the studio in about an hour, joining us to talk about something rather different, but he is an absolute paragon of what Fabio describes, partly because of the circumstances of his upbringing. But that's why I began by asking how you would feel if you couldn't go to the police or the NHS without knowing that you would be treated negatively and differently as a consequence of your skin colour. And if you don't care about that, then I mean, it's not fine, but it's tragic, isn't it? And it just feels that that's the direction that we're going in. Rishi is in Broadhaven. What makes it institutional, Rishi?
Good morning, James. Thank you for taking this conversation. I'm kind of struggling, a bit like previous callers, because you're looking at it from sort of personal, anecdotal experience.
Course.
But I think the word you used, may veer away from institutional, is the unconscious element of it as well.
Yeah.
Which is then spread, sadly, across society. And it's not what me wanting to be accusational, but it's just recognising my experience from my teaching background and seeing other teachers of colour feeling and experiencing similar. So with mine, may I give the anecdotal experience for myself?
Yes, absolutely.
Essentially, I saw myself as, I'm not in the profession now, I love it. I love children, that's what got me into the teaching profession. And it can be seen by the love that those children that are now adults have for me when they meet me in the street. I would consider myself to have been an average to sometimes below average teacher with regard to some elements of teaching.
Okay.
But in terms of the anecdotal experience, when I was teaching in one school, the treatment of myself versus another colleague was one where I was meted a statutory allowance of leave for mourning the passing of my father and the time to bury him versus a white colleague who and then I couldn't take any more leave. I went for the next day after his death and managed to teach to the best of my ability. And throughout that period of 2 weeks until the period of preparing for his funeral was only allocated the 1 week. And then another colleague got their term time dates mixed up for the half term for holiday and was unable to have the paid holiday, not in half term, but the week after. And that was on pay.
How do you persuade a sceptic, as I asked Babs, that is because of your ethnicity and not because of something else? That imbalance, that unfairness.
It's difficult. It's difficult. I mean, and but then I can give.
I want you to try. I don't know. I'm not going to have time for the other examples,
because I want you to try and explain to
somebody sceptical why you know or why you believe that was about your ethnicity and not about something else.
It may have been about my performance. As I said, that's why I said at the beginning, deem myself as an average to sort of below average teacher.
But no, it wouldn't be about your performance, would it? Because then it would be a punishment for your performance and it would have a logic to
it.
It wouldn't have happened in darkness. So, I mean, the thing is that you can't know. You can't prove it for sure.
No.
But what you can prove is that there are people who see someone who looks like you in an advert and it drives them mad. And she could have been your boss. In which case, the situation that you describe becomes all too easy to believe. You could have been somebody who, if they see a street full of people who look like you, he decides that's not a country that he wants to live in. And he's the Shadow Justice Minister at the moment, and he could have been your boss. And he would have been discriminating against you, whether consciously or not. Or you could be someone that Katie Lamb wants to deport because she doesn't think the country is culturally coherent enough. And she could have been your boss, and she could have been treating you differently from the white person with whom she feels cultural coherence. All of those things could be true, but it would be almost impossible to prove them without the kind of research and inquiry that the Metropolitan Police has just undertaken.
No, that I acknowledge, but I think what you can, the takeaway that you can take from my call is the experience that black people are feeling and experiencing some, as you correctly highlighed, is around a root and branch investigation. And it's there, and yet it's still justified, and yes, it's still brushed aside. There are, you know, it's littered with it. And so the problem is that our society, we're at a point where racism or the aspect of racism, whether it's heavily proven or not proven, is brushed aside and pushed aside. There's no such thing as unconscious bias.
There is.
There is. The white privilege that you were describing.
White privilege is unconscious society, bias, mate.
Yeah, absolutely. But society is pushing away, even when you've got the evidence, as you've highlighted, or you haven't got the evidence, like I haven't got, and it still has been allowed to brush aside and push away the fact that we indicatively live in a racist country, whereas if you're a black person or a person of colour, you are a second-class citizen.
And if I would have wanted...
And it's for people like yourself, and I'm grateful for people like yourself to be... Because it can only be from you. It can't come from me as a black person. It can't come from black people. It has to be... And you're in... I'm sorry to say, James, in a percentage of maybe 2% of white people that can bring across that narrative and show that it's the truth. But the truth will come out. The truth has come out in this investigation with the Met. It will come out in the NHS. I've got anecdotal experience in the NHS. But you know,
and these, I don't know. I don't know what the next chapter is, because it is. Yeah. It will be the text that I started the show with, from Jim, who just doesn't care, doesn't like these conversations, thinks that they're evidence of something. And then you've got the people who, I mean, just look the other way. People who like it. People who green light it. Where's the line between scepticism and gaslighting? You greet Rishi's claims with scepticism, but you're gaslighting somebody when you do that. And the line, which we haven't really pinned down or nailed, probably because I had a lot more to say about this than I realised, which I should probably apologise. The line, when does society become institutionally racist again? I think we might be really close to it when we run through that list of public figures who have really just embraced it recently.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock, pressure is building on Andrew Mountbatten Windsor to comply with a US investigation into Jeffrey Epstein. A Congress committee has requested he gives evidence over his friendship with the late sex offender. The committee doesn't have the power to compel Andrew to appear, and he denies any wrongdoing. Lawyer Spencer Coovin represented 9 of Epstein's victims.
I think that on behalf of the victims, we are encouraged. If Andrew wants to hold true to his promise that he wants to help victims of Epstein's abuse, then he should voluntarily come here to the United States and give testimony to the U.S. House on this issue.
2 people have been arrested after an XL bully dog attacked and killed a baby in southeast Wales. The 9-month-old boy died in Rhoggett on Sunday. Gwent police say the pair have been released on bail. A report has concluded discrimination against black people is baked into the governance of Britain's biggest police force. The internal review has called for structural change at the Metropolitan Police. It says it's committed to acting on the concerns. A potential split has emerged at the top of Labour after its new deputy leader said it should stick to its manifesto promises. Lucy Powell said the party risks eroding public trust if taxes are raised in the upcoming budget. Ms Powell later rode back, saying that she continued to support the Chancellor. Speaking to LBC this morning, the Cabinet Minister Steve Reid pushed back on the remarks.
We're not damaging trust in politics. We're getting on and delivering the manifesto. That's important. But Rachel, the Chancellor, gave a speech a couple of days ago in which she said, we're not going back to austerity. We will invest.
New figures from Halifax suggest average house prices in the UK rose by 0.6% in October. The increase, which follows a fall in September, brings the cost of a typical home to £299,862. And Thomas Tuchel has recalled Jude Bellingham and Phil Foden to his squad for the upcoming World Cup qualifiers. England take on Serbia and Albania next week. There's also a first call-up for Bournemouth midfielder Alex Scott. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 48 at 96.87. The pound buys $1.31 and a euro 13. LBC weather, sunshine and showers moving across the UK today. Another mild day as well, a high of 16 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Chase is the digital bank you can count on.
How so?
Because you get 1% cash back on your grocery shop.
Like on prosciutto?
Yeah, prosciutto.
And seaweed crackers?
Sure, those two.
Hang on, what about rotisserie chickens?
If it's in your grocery shop, Chase has got your cash back. Join today and get 1% cash back on debit card spending on groceries, fuel and everyday transport. Chase, see what your money can do. 18 plus UK residents eligibility applies. 1% cash back for your first year. Maximum £15 per month. Exceptions apply.
This is LBC from Global. Leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
It is 3 minutes after 11. I should have added to the conversation in the last hour, which we will return to regularly, because, you know, even if all we end up doing is chronicling it, the descent of the country into almost societal institutional racism is something that I can't ignore, either personally or professionally. But there's a brilliant piece in The Guardian today by Gabby Hinsliff, the columnist, who talks about it. Talks about part of this process, and what she spotted is that people are now saying in public what was once confined to social media. I spotted it in February. You will remember when that woman who was doing jewellery service at the same time as me started telling other jurors, unprompted, about how Michelle Obama was really a man and Volodymyr Zelensky was spending all the aid money sent to Ukraine on yachts. And I don't know why I found that so powerful. So important. But I think Gabby Hinsliff explains why today. So she's in the queue at the supermarket and a bloke starts slagging off Rachel Reeves, which is weird, but fair enough. But then he starts talking about why ex-military people who live nearby are perfectly equipped to take out the current government. Dominic Cummings actually ends that racist tweet I was telling you about earlier with the phrase regime change. So there are intersections with these madnesses. But this piece is brilliant about how my generation, middle-aged people, are becoming radicalised by the internet, and now that radicalisation is moving off the internet and into real life. So I just recommend that, because I always like to put something good in front of you. The next conversation we're going to have is horrible. And again, it's important, but it is one that I'd rather not have, but feel that we really, really should. Nick addressed the same territory earlier this morning and shared my, what's the word? I want discomfort about naming the man who undertook the hideous murders in Southport last year, which are themselves credited with prompting a huge rise in the number of far-right terrorists or wannabe terrorists being reported to prevent the number of people from that section of society. Now, I think, doubles the people being reported from a what we describe as an Islamist background. So I'll say his name once, and that will be it. Axel Rudakabana is the subject of an inquiry into how this atrocity could have happened, or perhaps more pertinently, how perhaps it could have been stopped. You'll remember that B.B. King, Elsie Dot Stancombe and Alice De Silva Aguirre were murdered. 10 others at the dance class in July of last year, subject of attempted murder. But the inquiry is something to which we have to pay quite a lot of attention. And it is the parents at that inquiry who today garner most of that attention. And so it should be. What you have is a picture of a family living in fear, but also stasis. Is that the right word? Sort of like stasis, living in fear and stasis. They're like frozen. They've done nothing. And just because it's very easy to attack the parents of this character for doing nothing doesn't mean it's wrong. Yeah, that's why you have inquiries, so that you ask these questions. Some of the evidence is close to unbelievable. And some of it will actually be familiar to a lot of people struggling with a loved one, with a child who needs help that can't be accessed. What this inquiry will end up looking at, I think, is whether or not they could have. Well, there's two elements to this conversation, and you'll notice I'm choosing my words quite carefully. whether or not they should have sought more help, I think is close to being answered already. Whether or not they should have sought more help, the answer looks like a big yes, right? And it's very, very easy to sit in judgment for us. Much, much harder for the families of the murdered girls to do so, and they choose their words very, very carefully. In a joint statement with Elsie Dott's father, David, Elsie Dott's father, David, Jenny Stankham, the mother, said, reading their statements has only added to the unbearable pain that David and I already live with every single day. This is talking about the parents. We knew early on that their lack of parenting played a part in all of this, but these statements reveal a failure of parenting on a whole new level. And this refers particularly to the presence and purchase of knives that the father, Alphonse, told the inquiry he knew that his son was probably doing. And he was buying knives with money that his father would pay him to shower. We know that his mother found knife packaging on the day of the attacks, but didn't seem, I quote, alarmed, end quotes, and then went back to bed. And that these are things that I think we can sit here and simply state something should have been done. But what I think intrigues me most this morning is the what. And I'm not quite sure who's best qualified to answer that question. I sadly have some knowledge, not in my direct family, but people I care about deeply, of violent children. Children who cannot regulate their emotions, to use the correct language, and for whom, much younger than this character, but for whom behaviour can be sufficiently violent and disruptive to merit 999 calls. And all I can tell you from that experience, and I think it's important to stress and to state that these are people that I love, It's so hard to get help. It's so unbelievably hard to get help. I presume it gets harder as the child gets older. Not easier. I presume it gets harder. But I, you know, I could tell you stories about children who are so obviously in need of care, 24-hour care. And I use the word care. You might prefer supervision. But the parents have to, well, you need to have either the freedom, the financial freedom to give up a full-time job, to not have a full-time job. One of you needs to be able to stay at home all the time, all the time. And even then, you're not going to be able to cope. And if it's a boy, particularly as they get older and their physical strength increases, your ability to handle it physically diminishes until the point where you don't really have any agency in those moments. And that's what I think this inquiry should really look at next. The question that I don't know the answer to is, what would have happened if they'd sought help? What would have happened if they'd sought help? I mean, hindsight is a wonderful thing. The country's full of knives. And very, very few parents would contemplate the possibility that their child was going to use one to do something as hideous as this. But the sense that these parents should have had a slightly better or a considerably better understanding or appreciation of that policy, that possibility, is going to be very, very hard to resist. He talks about how it was terrible that he did not check the label on a parcel containing knives because the label on it said bladed article. He told the inquiry he was half asleep when the Amazon delivery was made shortly before the attack, and he just put it on a pile of post rather than hiding it. And one of those knives went on to be used by his son in the Southport attack. And we know that he was, that the killer was expressing desperation to get his hands on a bigger knife that his father had hidden previously. The picture that will chill many of you is of his father lying in bed when his son came in and started lightly stabbing the bed with a smaller knife, asking where the bigger knife had been hidden. He describes his own feelings of being extremely vulnerable. He says he was begging his son to stop, and recognizing his son was now armed with a new knife he was not familiar with, but he did not call the police. He also told the hearing that he had become his son's, quote, obedient servant by the time he found poison and a bow and arrow in his bedroom. He said he noticed the weapon under his son's bed and a container with a substance inside later revealed to be ricin in the bedroom. This was a week before the attack. These are parents who are afraid of their children. These are parents who are terrified of their own child. And I don't know what the hell you do in that situation. And that, arguably, is one of the hardest questions I've ever asked you. Fits very much into the category of conversation that I mentioned to you at the top of the show, where the number of people qualified to contribute will be quite small. Well, no, actually, it won't be as small as you might imagine. But the combination of question here is quite straightforward. The first bit is, what's it like to be frightened of your own child? 03456060973. And the second question is, what help can you get? What help can you get? Because let's be absolutely clear why we have inquiries like this. It is to work out how the unthinkable happens. And if you can work out how the unthinkable happens, then you make it less likely that it will happen again. So, tempting though it is to chalk this up as a sort of biblical evil or as a sort of primal conduct, it will be like every other action undertaken by a human being. It will be in part a consequence of what went before. Who can look me in the eye and tell me that they would not want to do, they would not want society to do, governments to do, authorities to do, everything in their power to prevent anything even similar to this from happening again? Right? Answer, no one. We all. But there are countless families in this country where the parents are physically frightened of their children. And their children will be displaying an array of mental health problems and other issues. That's not the subject matter here. It's quite an odd thing to focus on if you are concerned about ensuring that this doesn't happen again. But what I want is an insight into what it's like to be physically frightened of your own child. And for those of us who have little or no experience of that, what does help look like? Because I could sit here now, and I think 10 years ago I would have done, and I could thump the desk and rant and rave about how awful these parents are, and they have clearly, I made some hideous decisions and some hideous mistakes. But what I can't tell you is what they should have done differently. And even if I came up with a theory on what they should have done differently, I can't tell you what help they would have got. And that's what I want to know. So there are two elements to this conversation. The first is going to be really hard to talk about, but I hope that you can. You know that you'll get a sympathetic ear from me. What's it like to be frightened of your own child? He talks about being his son's obedient servant. He talks about feeling extremely vulnerable. And I make no apology for stating that these parents have made hideous, hideous mistakes and misjudgments. But underneath all of that, you have a home in which essentially a grown man has got his children, got his own parents terrorized and terrified. In that scenario, what should they have done? And there are two elements to that. It's what should they have done, quite easy to answer. They should have got help. They should have got him this. They should have done that. But how feasible would that have been? I just want to know what happens in these kind of scenarios. Hit the numbers now, you will get through. Fairly straightforward. Question number one, what's it like to be physically frightened of your own child? Okay. 03456060973. And how much help is there for you when you find yourself in that situation? That is the best way to phrase it. How much help is there for you in that situation. Hit the numbers now. You will get through.
This is LBC.
Chase is the digital bank that could boost your savings.
Ooh, tell me more.
When you join Chase, you could earn 4.5% AER variable. That includes a 2% AER fixed boost for 12 months on top of our standard saver rate.
Oh, yeah, nice.
Yep, our savings boost could help you reach your goals, like that once-in-a-lifetime adventure. Get our best easy access saver offer today. Search Chase Boosted Saver. Offer may be withdrawn at any time. 18-plus UK residents available to new current account customers for your first 31 days. Eligibility applies. 4.41% CROIS. Terms apply.
A winter walk, the cold ground underfoot. You notice footprints. All those people gone before you, evident only by the tracks they left. Tracks. Tire tracks. Tires. That reminds you.
Haven't had the tires checked in a while.
If caring for your Audi's on your mind, now's the time. With £150 off Audi service plans available until the 30th of November, buy online or visit Five Oaks Audi. Audi. Vorsprung durch Technik. Tires are checked, not replaced. Excludes vehicles over 15 years old, engines 4 litres or more, and e-tron level 1 plans. Audi Finance.
You know how fans shout at football matches?
Oh, wake up!
That's because sound is the most effective way to tell the players they're rubbish. Works in advertising too. Because when you amplify your advertising using radio, your campaign is 49% more likely to get noticed. See radio differently at radiocentre.org.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
19 minutes after 11. Need a little bit of time just to prepare people who've rung in to come on air, because obviously the subject matter is incredibly fraught. But the other element that we didn't touch upon in the introduction is the perfectly understandable reluctance of parents to put their child in the hands of authority. I mean, how hard must it be to have somebody sectioned, for example, or to make the decision that you can no longer care for this person and that they are potentially a harm to themselves and, in this case, to others. But the words that jumped out from the coverage to me were the words extremely vulnerable, which is not how a parent should feel in the presence of their child, and not how many of us can conceive of what that would be like. And then having become the obedient servant of this man who was terrorizing his own home. I don't, however, dispute what the parents of the murdered children have said with regard to the responsibilities that the parents had. I just want detail. I want a better understanding of what it is they failed to do. So Alex and Sergio Aguirre, Alice's parents, addressed their statement to the parents responsible and to the system that failed. It read, "We call upon lawmakers and authorities to recognise the urgent need for reform. Parents must be held accountable for the actions and behaviours of their children when they fail to take reasonable steps to prevent harm. The system must be strengthened to identify risks, act upon them, and protect the innocent before tragedy strikes." So while we seem to be broadly agreed that more should have been done by this man's parents, we don't know what exactly, and perhaps even more importantly, we don't know what would have happened if they had done those things. Lindsay is in Blythe. Lindsay, what made you pick up the phone?
Basically, we're a family with a complex needs child. He's 16-year-old, he's 6'2". He has severe autism learning disabilities. And we've been campaigning around the whole child on adult violence because there is no services to support. Now, I have a background in special educational needs. I've worked with challenging children. I've worked in the education system with the likes of my son. So I'm lucky. I've got skills. I've got experience. I've got training. And we struggle. We struggle every day. We were in crisis in January due to a medication issue where he was on full-on 24-hour attack, where our lives were at risk daily. And there was no support for us.
Let me pause you there. And if it's not too traumatic for tell people who have no idea what you're talking about what that means, because I'm just going to start you off by suggesting you have to hide all the knives in the house.
Yes, we have locks on doors. We have fingerprint locks. So we either can't get into rooms or we can't get out of rooms.
In your own house, you've got fingerprint locks?
Yes, we have fingerprint locks on our front door. We have key code locks that you'd have in a hospital on bedroom doors. We have key turn locks to lock things away. We have magnetic locks on. We have different types of locks depending on the situation. And that's to keep him safe and us. But everything is geared around keeping our son safe, and there are no services around keeping us as parents safe at all. There's nothing.
So when you read the details of the home life of this killer, what is your reaction?
I haven't read all the details, and I've literally just had a message from a friend saying you need to ring in and tell your story because he knows it. Okay. But I know that family will have been asking for help. Guaranteed.
He was discharged by CAMHS, but they weren't asking. Yeah. I mean, they haven't done half of the... It's more about... Because they haven't done the fingerprint locks and they haven't done those sort of things, but they weren't living in that 24-hour threat of violence that you describe. Who should they contact? I mean, this is the thing that I want help with.
Yeah.
Imagine it was me.
Yeah.
And I can cope while they're 6, 7, yes, 8.
Exactly,
but as you say, suddenly they're 6'2" and they could knock me out in a heartbeat.
Absolutely.
Who do I call?
We were told to call a social worker.
Right.
And we were told they would come out and help. Now, actually, the social worker would not come out to help because they have to put themselves they're going to be at risk. They can't put themselves at risk. So what normally happens is the police come out. Now, if they've got capacity, then they're arrested.
Yeah.
And then hopefully things will happen from there. If they're over the age of 18, they're classed as an adult and they go down the legal route. If they're under 18, it goes to a safeguarding panel who then decide what level of risk it is. And then, hopefully, if there are services available, then services are put in. However, in our family, because he has a learning disability, there are no services because they've been non-developed. The only option for us was to put our child into residential care.
And that's almost impossible to secure.
Well, there's a waiting list. Even if we wanted a one-night overnight respite, currently, there's a 2-year waiting list for that one night a month.
Yeah. Yeah, I know a bit about it. And also, they're closing facilities, not actually that far from where you are, without
exactly
giving the parents any time at all to find new alternative accommodation.
I know about fingerprint locks. I know about door locks. But families don't, because they don't live in that world. So unless you've got somebody to tell you about these sorts of things, they don't know they exist. That's it. There's no support for families to say, actually, have you done this? Let's do this. Let's come in immediately. Let's make your home safe for everybody. But as long as the child is safe,
then everybody else is safe as well.
Nobody safeguards the parents. Nobody.
No. And this phrase here that the father in this case talks about being the obedient servant of his son and talks about feeling extremely vulnerable.
Because the risk is if he doesn't do X, Y, Z for that child, then the likelihood is that child will attack and cause serious injury. So you're in a crisis situation where you've got to manage your own personal safety in that moment. And unless someone comes along and helps you get out of that crisis, you're just living in crisis. It's like you've been under an armed robbery every single second of every day. And in the moment, you can't get out of that.
And you're a professional. I mean, that is such an interesting point, isn't it, Lindsay? This is your world. This is your world. And even you are at your wit's end a lot of the time.
Yes.
Can I?
But my husband doesn't have those toolboxes.
No.
He doesn't have that experience, that training, that know-how. And that's the point. I've then got to support my son, who is in crisis because of other people's negligence. And I've then got to support my husband dealing with my son and help him process everything and keep us all safe whilst also trying to look after myself and try and fight to get support for us as a family.
I don't know if this is an appropriate question, but you're so articulate, I'm going to ask you anyway.
Thank you.
What would happen if you weren't you? What would be the state of your family if you
We wouldn't be together. We've already been told that our son was so complex that
if he'd been with any other family, he would have been behind a locked door age 7 on a 4-to-1 basis.
Yeah.
Age 7.
And for families who can't cope?
The children goes into residential care. Or, in the case of in our town 10 years ago, a mother was killed by her son after begging for support, and she was killed. And the serious case review highlighted that legislation had not changed and needed to change to sort of what the day and age looks like.
So, final question, I promise,
This is my subject.
I know it is. I've got to be aware of things like the news, Lindsay, and stuff like that. You know, it's not just you and me having a cup of tea at the moment. Although, on a good day, I hope it feels like that. But this story, and I know you're not across all the details of the inquiry, but when the Southport killings began to unfold, and when some of the detail of the home life of the culprit began to emerge, I presume you respond to that differently from the rest of us.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I know that there's family in crisis who are begging for help. Plain simple.
And it's not there.
It's not there. And what's worse is that the authorities and the caseworkers involved know it's not there, but they can't do anything about it because the money's not there to put the services that are needed.
And that is what we should all hope the inquiry establishes and addresses. I'm going to end with a really weird question, if that's all right with you.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about a good day at home?
Oh, my son is amazing. He's charismatic. He's hilarious. He's funny. People want to be around him. His ex-staff used to fight over who was actually going to work with him because he would lift their mood. Because when everything's good and safe and happy, he's full of life and laughter and joy. And he is the best person. And I am so privileged to have him as my son. Privileged.
I'm glad I asked. Thank you, Lindsay.
Yeah.
And what can people do to find out more about the campaign that you're embarked upon?
Just support. If you hear child on adult violence, just click on it, read it, share it. Just make a noise.
Okay, I'll give your full name, shall I, so that people can read up on your story as well?
Yes, absolutely.
So it's Lindsay Brown. I know you spoke to the BBC in March of this year, and I know that you're working tirelessly in this area. Well, thank you. I'm glad your friend was listening. I'm not going to tell you off for the fact that you didn't have me on in your house at the moment.
I'm at work.
Well, that's all right. Well, that's allowed. On this case, you can have a free pass, but next time I'll need a letter off your mum by the end of break, all right, to explain why.
All right, got that.
Thank you. 11:30 is the time. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Dominic Ellis is here now with your headlines.
Pressure's building on Andrew Mountbatten Windsor to travel and comply with a US investigation into Jeffrey Epstein. A Congress committee's requested that he gives evidence over his friendship with the late sex offender. Two people have been arrested over the death of a baby who was killed by an XL bully dog in Monmouthshire. The 9-month-old died in Rogget on Sunday. And ITV has confirmed it's in talks with Sky over a possible sale of its media and entertainment branch. It says a deal would value the division at $1.6 billion. LBC weather, sunshine and showers will move across the UK today. Another mild day, a high of 16 degrees.
This is LBC.
For the nappies, peekaboos and tea parties. Mess, tantrums and sleepless nights. All those yo-yos, action figures and shinies. Lifts to mates, lifts to parties, lifts everywhere. For each and every one of those teenage years. Let's be honest. You probably owe your parents one. So tell them about pension credit. It could boost their pension income by an average of over £4,000 a year. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, what you thought you were getting may not be what you ended up with. From unexpected site fee increases, running costs, a huge depreciation in value, many owners feel they've been missold. If you think this might be you, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive the compensation you're entitled to. Text ASSIST to 78900 to find out more. That's ASSIST to 78900.
At Morrisons, we've got all the chockies. Get Cadbury selection boxes for £2.25 and advent calendars for £1.25. That's half price with your more card. Morrisons, making more of Christmas. Majority of stores, offers and prices may vary online and Morrison's daily more card app required 18 plus box without more card £4.50 ends 16th of November. Calendar £2.50 without more card ends 9th of November.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top rated Google reviews,
Keep on smiling.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome aboard your flight to Geneva. This is your captain speaking, and I would like to take a second to welcome our very special guests. All the skis and snowboards that enjoy a free flight to Winter Wonderland.
The best skiing experiences start with the right airline. Book your winter holiday now on Swiss.com and enjoy free gear transport.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 60 60973.
11:32 is the time. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC, where the ease with which we can all conclude that the parents of the South Force killer could have done more is not a reason why we shouldn't arrive at that conclusion. I have. But I also, because you know how my brain works, I want to know what they could have done differently. I want to know how they could have done more. And I want to know what would have happened if they had pressed the alarm button sooner or more often. You can lose your place with CAMHS for missing appointments. And if you've ever worked with a dysregulated child or lived with a dysregulated child, you'll know that getting to appointments can be an almost impossible task on a bad day. So what should they have done differently, and what would have happened if they'd tried? All of which is underpinned by the question of what it is like to live in a house, to be a parent who is physically frightened of their child, either all the time or on a bad day, which I thought Lindsay rather beautifully distinguished between. That's why I asked her at the end about what a good day looks like, because it's easy to forget sometimes when you're discussing this kind of thing in the context of the hideous events of Southport that we're talking about human beings and we're talking about children. Tina is in Southend. Tina, what made you pick up the phone?
Hi. I guess my experience is a bit more low level, certainly not to the degrees that these poor people have been through. But I have lived with a violent child day in, day out, and I know that what it did to me was it changes you as a person. You change your behaviours and you regulate yourself because you're forever trying to avoid a flare, basically. And you never know when that's going to come. My child could go from 0 to 100 in a heartbeat.
When did it start? Do we know why?
Not really. I think very likely because her father and I separated.
Right.
And we moved into a different house. And within 12 months of that happening, we were living a completely different life.
And then she reaches the age where you couldn't, even if you wanted to, physically contain her.
Do anything physically when a child is coming at you like that anyway. I mean, my child would bite, kick, scratch, you know, the verbal stuff. I mean, I can't even tell you the things that were said. Horrific. And there's an element of shame to all of this. Something I would like to say is actually it's really difficult to reach out and explain to people what's going on in your life, in your house, with your nearest and dearest. You know, I grew this person. I desperately wanted to have children. And then you come to a point where they want to physically and mentally attack you day in, day out.
What does help look like? Who do you ask for? Because, I mean, this is so... I have this little catchphrase. Gosh. It sounds a bit inadequate, Tina, today, but some of the subjects that engage us the most together in the mornings are the ones about which you know nothing until you suddenly have to know everything. And that's in this category, really, isn't it? I don't know anything at all about what you do in the event of needing help dealing with your own dangerous child. And then suddenly, when you're in that situation, you need to know everything yesterday. So what is the help? What do you do? Who do you call?
We went through all services. We went to the GP. We went to the county council. They have an early support unit. But we went through CAMHS. My child was assessed. Eventually, what we were told was they're just naughty.
Okay.
Because they could regulate their behaviour in school and they didn't take it with them to school, that meant that it was something that we had done, that I had done, that I was responsible for, because it was happening in my household. I've got another child. They lived through it as well, an older child who also went through that, who they called the police. My child was arrested and removed from the house.
So one child called the police on the other child?
Yes, okay. Because it was completely out of control. You know, I can remember an occasion where we had to flee to the garden with the dogs and my other child, and the youngest then locked us out of the house and was waving a knife out through the window. I didn't know what they were going to do. I didn't know if they were going to hurt themselves. I didn't know if they were going to continue to destroy my house. It was absolutely terrifying. And like I said to you, there is a real shame element. Mm. And when people come and you have to tell your story again and again, you have to give examples of the times she's kicked you in the face and made your nose bleed, or the times that she's destroyed things that were important to you and stood and laughed at your distress. It's very, very tough.
Did she pose a threat to people outside the house, or was it always confined to you and
her siblings? Always confined to us within. But that extended to myself, her father, her sister. We were all targets of it.
And are things better now?
They no longer live with me.
Okay.
We came to a point where they couldn't live with me any longer. It was after an experience on Christmas Day, where she upended the entire Christmas table.
Yeah.
Then barricaded herself into the living room, having hurt me again.
Yeah.
They were removed from the house, and we made the decision that they would live with their father full time from then on.
So are they in residential care? Or
no.
Sorry, amazingly, you don't have to tell me.
Amazingly, things have got better.
Okay.
They are more able to regulate themselves. They are still a very difficult person to live with. You don't know what you're going to get. One minute it can be sweetness and light, and the next minute they're back to calling you the worst things you could probably ever imagine. But they are extremely intelligent. They're very, very academic. And they are putting their energies into academia at the minute.
Okay, well, that's a happy ending of sorts, albeit that the separation must be very difficult for you in many ways, and of course in other ways it'll be a relief, and that'll make you feel guilty, and that's where the shame kicks in again. So it's a hideous cycle. Thank you for sharing that, because the simple question of what it's like to live with a child that you are frightened of is not going to have any simple answers. Tina, thank you. This is me now, not Tina, correcting something I read out a moment ago. Cam's mental health nurse here. If you let Cam's know that you can't attend appointments, then the child will not be discharged. It's multiple DNAs, as in not turning up without reasons and without explanations and warnings, that may result in a discharge. That seems a more reasonable state of affairs. And the reason why we're having this conversation is precisely because there is an irresistible sense. And even if you wanted to resist it, you wouldn't, when you've read the statements from the families of the murdered children, that there is a sense that this family must have done more, should have done more, and that is a correct conclusion. They could and should have done more. But what we're not learning yet is what that is precisely, and what would have happened had they sought that help. I mean, he clearly should have been in residential care, very, very high levels of supervision in residential care. And there isn't any evidence that the parents sought that conclusion, but what would have happened if they had? You're talking about a two-year waiting list for one day of respite care, then it's not as if you pick up the phone and say, I can't cope anymore and I'm worried that he's going to hurt someone, and he'll be spirited away to a place of safety by tea time tomorrow. Kate's in Barnet. Kate, what would you like to say?
Yeah, thank you, James, taking my call. And I really appreciate you addressing this subject, because it is very difficult.
Oh,
and I completely sympathise with Tina in Southport and the caller before, because it resonates 100% with my experience. So I have a 14-year-old boy who's ADHD, meaning he has autism and ADHD, with learning difficulties too. So his profile changed dramatically after COVID about sort of 4 years ago when he was first diagnosed. But he's always been a very calm and placid boy until he became depressed and catatonic. So this diagnosis resulted in the issuing of medication. And the medication has turned him into an aggressive and violent child, unfortunately. Not all the time, so it's sporadic and can happen at any time. Much like your previous callers have described to you, it can happen out of the blue and when you least expect it. So your back could be turned, you could be making a meal by the cooker, and then suddenly you'll get something thrown at you, or attacked
from behind or from the front. I'm sporting a swollen black eye at the moment based on an altercation I had with him yesterday. He refused to get up and have his shower to go to school.
Right.
And I ended up being pushed into a solid oak door.
Where do you get help from? I mean, you've clearly had medical interventions if he's got a prescription, albeit that it may not necessarily be the right medication. What's the next level? I mean, if things get worse.
He's been with CAMHS for many years now, since he was about 9, 10, and there's a limit to what they can do. He's reviewed every 6 months by a psychiatrist, and he's had psychotherapy.
Yeah.
But you're always in a holding situation where you know that you're going to be off-boarded because there are other children behind you and they just don't have the resources to be able to see to everyone and give them the attention they need. We had a social worker assigned based on his recent behaviour.
Right.
But there's a limit to what she can do because there's no safeguarding concerns in the home. So they've given us respite, which is a care worker who comes to the home, but only 4 hours a week. But that's an amazing help for me. I have to.
There's two parents
in the home. There's two parents.
Yeah.
I'm not on my own, but my husband works nights. And so it's him and my sister and his sister, sorry, who are with him. During the nighttime hours, which is really scary. And what happens is you begin to regulate yourself. You live in a state of fear.
Constantly.
You can't relax in your own home, because you don't know when the attack's coming. And like your previous callers have said, it's almost like, you know, we're repeating each other, but it's so true. We hide the knives, we lock the doors, we've got locks on our bedrooms, so we've got somewhere to run and hide if he decides to.
In your own home, from your own boy.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's life, isn't it?
Well, it is for you, and it's not fair, but you're right, it is. It is life. Just hang up the phone or tell me off if this is an inappropriate question or if I'm being crass. But if things don't get better and you begin to worry about threats posed outside the house, what do you do then?
Well, this is where residential care comes into play. You get put on a waiting list, I suppose, to whisk your child away into a residential setting.
Would you make that call?
Not at the moment.
No, I know, but parent to parent, we would probably all make it a bit too late, wouldn't we? Because you wouldn't want to go there early. You wouldn't want to press that button early.
Oh, no. No, not at all. And you're right. You know, there is, and your previous caller mentioned about the element of shame. You know, you have these big dreams for your children, don't you? You want them to be good citizens. You want them to go to university. You want them to get a trade or, you know, contribute to society.
Yes.
Yeah. And then when it all goes pear-shaped, you don't know what to do because you feel embarrassed. There is that embarrassment element.
Yeah, that's what keeps popping up, shame and embarrassment.
Exactly.
And you know, that is a big part of the reason. I don't know whether it will turn up more in the inquiry that we're talking about this hour, but that why didn't you do more? Is it because I didn't want people to know how bad things were at home?
And
I didn't want people to know how frightened I am of my own son.
Right. And you heard him, you know, he was a kind of a servant to his son. And that scares me because my son's only 14. So there's an element of physical strength there that I can contain.
It's only going to get, he's only going to get bigger, isn't he? He's only going to get stronger.
Bigger and stronger. Yeah.
Stay safe, won't you?
Thank you so much.
No, well, thank you so much. I wish there weren't people listening to this programme who were so qualified to make the contributions that they're making. I've got a guest, I told you Eddie's with us, Eddie Marsan, who bizarrely was cited earlier by a texter about one of the great advocates for and articulators of the importance of empathy, which was relevant to the conversation in the first hour, relevant as well, of course, to this one. But I'm going to quickly squeeze in Michelle, who has got sort of constructive advice on some of the or answers to some of the questions that we've been asking. Michelle is in Shrewsbury. Michelle, what can you tell us?
Good morning, and thank you so much for having us on.
You're very welcome.
I run a national organisation that provides support to parental figures who are experiencing abusive behaviours from their child. And what I wanted to do today was just reach out and let people know there is support out there. And that nobody is alone. And what we do know is the majority of parents have been asking for support for decades, but long before their child has become an adult.
or even 16. So the law is really clear now. We were really privileged to be asked to consult on the Domestic Abuse Act, and child apparent abuse is recognised as a form of abuse if the child's age 16 or above. I think what I'm hearing this morning, which is consistent, is that parents are reaching out, which we see as a service, but the framework, the policy and the scaffolding around professionals to understand all the nuances around this form of behaviour and to be able to provide support at the earliest opportunity is what's missing. And so what's happening is increase of risk, increase of different forms of behaviour that's escalating in the home. And what I also wanted to highlight is actually what we see statistically across the board is the behaviours are often targeted towards one parental figure,
yes,
only at home. There's no necessarily link between behaviours towards a parent or caregiver in the home to then go on and commit atrocious crimes or further behaviours.
And that's the fingers crossed territory as well, isn't it? Because, you know, the idea that we'll just batten down the hatches, I'll deal with it all, I'm the target, and hopefully they'll get better, but I don't want to call the outside world into this nightmare because I'm so ashamed and I'm scared of what they'll do to my son.
So I would disagree with that, to be honest. It's not about battling down the hatches. Parents are already reaching out for help. Over 50% of those that we support have been asking for help
I'm talking about the family in the Southport case, actually, who seem to have sort of cut themselves loose from the support network available.
I mean, it's really interesting. I mean, we haven't really commented on that case.
I won't expect you to.
No. But what I was about to say is, you know, I've heard from yourselves today, you know, around dad saying he feels obedient servant.
Yeah.
And I've also read statements from both mum and dad where they wish that they spoke out earlier.
Which
I don't disagree with. However, I think we also have to be careful here in terms of parental blame. And
yeah,
I'm talking across the board.
Absolutely we do.
And my heart and the rest of our team's heart will always be with those, you know, the victims from that atrocious attack. I'm not walking away from that. But I think what we need to do is look at how can we learn from this and actually learn. We're not having the lessons have been learned speech again. How can we inform practice of professionals? And only when we start to put parents at the centre and go, okay, what's happening for you? Build up their trust and actually be able to look at effective support and nearly stuff of opportunities. We are sadly, I believe, going to see similar situations in the future within homes or further afield.
Please God, no. But this is your field. If you would briefly tell me about what is your organisation called and how can people contact you?
No, of course. But before we do that, I want just to highlight to you, we know that one parent every 19 days is killed in England and Wales. So while I appreciate you're saying, God, no, I hope that doesn't happen. Unfortunately,
well, you said that it was going to happen more and I hope it doesn't happen more. But just tell people about your organisation, if you would.
Yeah, of course. So PEGS is a social enterprise. We're based in Shropshire. We provide practical and emotional support to parental figures.
PEGS, P-E-G-S.
Yeah, Parental Education Growth Departments, PEGS. We provide free support up and down the country to parental figures who are experiencing abusive behaviours from their home. We provide different consultancy and training support to absolutely upskill and empower those professionals at the earliest opportunity to recognise families' needs and to work with them effectively.
And the extent, the depth, the width of that need is something that we need more people like you to be shouting from the rooftops as regularly as possible. Thank you, Michelle. 11:50 is the time. The website there, PEGS. Or PEG support, PEGsupport.co.uk. It's 10 to 12.
This is LBC.
Things are really heating up in the country's smallest house.
Dad!
Squealed Mia Mouse.
We could save around £100 by setting the boiler flow temperature to 60 degrees.
And turning radiators down in rooms we don't use,
interrupted Mo.
Yes, Mo.
Turn them down,
not off, said Mia.
Plus finding and blocking drafts,
said Mo.
Should save enough to increase our allowance.
A little saves a lot. You could save around £100 a year off your energy bills with 3 tips at gov.uk/cleanenergy.
You plan a holiday, you plan a commute, meal plans, career plans, even workouts need a plan. So doesn't it stand to reason that your money has one too? Because the sad truth is, if it doesn't, it's just sitting there, barely growing, if at all. That's why you need a money plan, and Quilter can help. It's a lot easier to stick to than a workout plan. Money needs a plan. Quilter. Pensions, investments, advice. Find out more at quilter.com.
Private healthcare sounds pricey.
At Benenden Health, it's less than £16 per person per month.
Just for GP calls.
For a 24/7 GP helpline, physio, diagnostics and more. Now, tell me.
All about my medical history.
No, no medical questionnaires or hidden charges. We like to call it
healthcare done different.
Spot on. Benenden Health. Healthcare done different. Fee review periodically. 6 month wait for some services. T&Cs apply. Selected surgical procedures after 6 months. 24 in Northern Ireland. UK only. Visit benenden.co.uk.
At Laithwaite, we go to great lengths to bring you great wine. We go far and wide. Searching high, and we mean really high, and low. And we mean stored deep underground in a cave low. Off the shelf? We don't go there. Off the beaten track? We certainly go there. And the best bit is, we even come to you. Order now at laithwaites.co.uk. Laithwaites. We stop at nothing to bring you great wine.
A message from TfL.
I saw him in the local news a few days after. His name's Rakesh. They had to put him into a coma just because I didn't look again at that turning. He had two kids. How did I not see his bike ahead of me? Well, I didn't look again. He didn't make it.
Drivers, take another look, not a life. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters.
James O'Brien on LBC.
It's 11:53. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Because I wanted to give Michelle some space, I don't have as long with the next guest as I wanted, but I did get a mention. He did get a mention earlier in the programme by complete coincidence. Eddie Marson, I read from Fabio, gave a great interview the other day, and something stuck out at the end. Although he was talking about acting, I think it's relevant to this. He talked about the exercise in empathy, and if there's one thing that we need more of at the moment, it's empathy. If you can empathise with those experiencing something that you're not experiencing, then you can help fix those problems, and it's probably the only way that you can. And it reminded me, Eddie, of the quote you provided from the Roman playwright Terence when you were appointed as the vice president of Mount View Theatre School, which is why you're here today. That quote being, "Nothing human is alien to me." You've not just lived your career by that mantra, you've kind of lived your life by it as well.
Well, it kind of freed me up. I think mentally, when I went into Mount View, I wasn't in a good place, really. And it initially enabled me to forgive myself and then to kind of see other people's perspectives. I remember being at Mount View I went in and I was full of like kind of working class anger and I was out Danny Dyer. And a friend of mine gave me a book by Lao Tzu, the Tao Te Ching, and said, "Why don't you explore the idea of paradox?" And I never knew that paradox, I never even knew that word existed. And I read this poetry and it literally opened my mind. It was like a form of meditation. And then I started meditating at the same time. And so all those things together, also while studying the idea of creating a character and the Buddhist idea of there being no self, all those things came together for me to think that nothing human is alien to me is such a wonderful way to perspective to live life.
So when you get a call inviting you to become part of Mount View, to become a vice president and help other young people perhaps make some of the progress and go on some of the journeys that you've been on, it was, I suspect, something of a no-brainer.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've got four teenagers and I know, especially because of social media, I know how hard it is for teenagers to find themselves and to navigate the world at the moment. Social media is so binary that if someone has an opinion at the moment, you hate them because of that opinion. Where years ago, we used to work with people who had different opinions from us, but we knew that they were a good husband or a good father or a good colleague, so you could see the humanity beyond the opinion. And what drama does, and theatre and film, is it allows you to sit and explore really difficult subjects within paradox and nuance.
We've talked before about how it would probably be harder today for someone from your background to get into your profession and into drama school. That's obviously something that you're keen to address.
Yeah, I think a lot of that's due to the cost of living now. When I first started acting, it took me 7 years to earn a living as an actor, and I was a waiter, a labourer, sold theatre tickets. But you could live in London and rent a room and a flat, and it could be affordable. Now there's no way you could live in a big urban center while you was working as a waiter. That's why mainly kids, and it's not their fault, but kids from more privileged backgrounds have a leg up because they have the money to stay where everything's happening, you know.
I'm trying to think what I've seen you in most recently. It's probably King and Conqueror, is it? Is that in terms of...
Yeah, probably King and Conqueror, yeah.
Playing King Ed, what are you up to at the minute?
I've just finished a show for FX in New York, and I'm at the moment we're shooting the second season of Supercell.
What would you say... I love Supercell. What would you say to somebody listening to this who thinks that... drama school or theatre school is either for the birds or for the toffs? By birds, I mean as in, you know, for the birds. I'm not being misogynistic. I just want to make that clear. I can't be too careful these days, Eddie.
I would say go for it. I would say there's I think the government have just changed the curriculum, yeah, include more arts, which I think is a great step forward.
Daily Mail's very cross.
Well, they would be. But I honestly think I was thinking back to when you have a kid who's bullied at school and has no confidence, people don't realise how welcoming being on stage is because you don't see the audience and no one's going to interrupt you. And then it's a safe space for which people can express and explore difficult subjects. But I would tell anybody... to just go for it, you know, that nothing's impossible. You just got to work hard, be kind, work hard, and keep a clear mind and an open heart, and it's the best way to go.
What does being a vice president involve? Because you're doing it alongside Dame Elaine Page and Dame Judi Dench. You're the only one who hasn't got a title. What does it involve? What will your vice presidential duty?
Well, it's also Giles Torrere is doing it as well. He's a brilliant actor. Well, I went in on Tuesday and I spoke to the kids on Tuesday and we had a great session with them. There was one young girl, said to me, I've been told I have to network and I'm not very good at parties. Do you have any advice? And I said, I swear to you, I never got a job at a party. it's just literally showing them, telling them that although it's going to be difficult, because it is a difficult profession, that it's going to be all right. If you just stick with it, they're going to be okay.
I wasn't overlooking your OBE. I was just wondering when the knighthood was going to arrive. I was in touch with David earlier this week, David Harewood, who's just opened in Othello at the Haymarket, and he, of course, has assumed a very important role at RADA as well.
Yes.
Do you think that the less obvious your background is, you know, the to come from a background where developing an ambition to be an actor would be a little bit out of the ordinary, gives you more care and concern for the young people coming up now?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I think David, I went to listen to David's lecture he gave, the Jonathan Dimbleby lecture, and it was brilliant and so inspirational. And for young people from an underprivileged background, for whatever reason, you have a lack of privilege, to have somebody who's overcome those obstacles and who can inspire you is a really important thing. David's fantastic at doing that.
So I haven't had my acting shoes on since 1993, Eddie. When I, having failed the first year at university, I decided it was time to put this stuff behind me. And I am giving you a world exclusive here. I'm signing up for a course in January. I'm going to start stepping back onto the stage again. So I'll be on the phone to you looking for some introductions.
Some tips.
Yeah. I want tips and introductions. So actually, you can keep the tips. I want introductions to casting directors. Eddie Marson, it's always a pleasure to see you. And I mean, Mount View Theatre School is easy to find online if you're tempted by what Eddie has described or you want to find out more about it. Thank you, mate. It's 1 minute after 12. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, some breaking news this hour. Julia Von Delt, who claimed to be Madeleine McCann, has been found guilty of harassing the missing girl's family. But the 24-year-old Polish national has been cleared of stalking Kate and Jerry McCann. Von Delt's co-defendant, Karen Sprague, who's 61, was cleared of all the charges against her. LBC's reporter George Ike has more details from Leicester Crown Court.
Julia Van Delt and Karen Spragg were crying and holding hands as the jury returned to deliver their verdicts. Julia Van Delt's been found guilty of harassment but not guilty of stalking the family of Madeleine McCann, while Karen Spragg was found not guilty of stalking or harassment. They gasped whilst holding hands in the dock as the jury foreman delivered that verdict. Now we know that the judge is intending to pass a sentence on Julia Van Delt in the next hour or so, and it's expected that that sentence, from what the judge has said in court, will be one of around 6 months, and with Julia Van Delt having been on remand in custody since she was arrested in February, it is possible that she could be freed any time now.
We'll bring you all the latest on that story throughout the afternoon. Political pressure is building on Andrew Mountbatten Windsor to comply with a US investigation into Jeffrey Epstein. Politicians have written to the King's brother requesting an interview over his links to Jeffrey Epstein. The committee doesn't have the power to compel Andrew to appear, and he also denies any wrongdoing. The Housing Secretary Steve Reid told LBC this morning that Andrew should seriously consider the request.
Well, I think any individual that can help with an investigation of that gravity should go and help if they can. He is a private individual, it's up to him, but I think people should do what they can to help.
A review of Britain's biggest police force has found racial discrimination is baked into its culture and governance. It says black staff at the Metropolitan Police are labelled confrontational, while others are treated more leniently. Scotland Yard says it recognises the scale of the challenge and that further change is needed. ITV has confirmed it's in talks with Sky over a possible sale of its media and entertainment branch. It says a deal would value the division at £1.6 billion. Shares in ITV surged as much as 19%. In early morning trading. And the England manager Thomas Tuchel has recalled Jude Bellingham and Phil Foden to his latest squad. Bellingham was left out of the last camp in October, while Foden hasn't played for his country since March. England played Serbia and Albania in World Cup qualifiers later this month. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 78 at 78.43. The pound buys $1.31 and €1.13. LBC weather, sunshine and showers will continue to move across the UK, and another mild afternoon, a high of 16 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Hey, Harry.
Hello, mate.
Got any tips?
Your best bet is to head to BetVictor.
Why's that?
They've got more features than you can shake a stick at. They've got cash out, they've got in-play football, racing, tennis, all your favourite sports. They've got the best odds guaranteed on racing, and then there's the Bet Builder. And of course, you've got the lucky dip. Blimey, dip! I've got to go, fella. It's Nacho Night at Casa Redknapp. And holy moly, I forgot the guacamole. Ay, caramba.
Listen to Harry and make your best bet at BetVictor. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. Gamblerware.org.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
It's 5 minutes after 12. I think, inspired by Eddie, we will actually have a look at how culture can change your life. Especially, and I hope this doesn't make me sound like I'm guilty of inverse snobbery, but if you go to a school like mine, then your parents are paying a lot of money to make sure that you have been exposed to things like poetry and drama, and not just in a classroom, but also on a stage. If you come from a background where it is not baked in, and it's not to do with wealth, and it's, there's no category. Stephen Mangan was in this week to record a full disclosure. He's not, we're not releasing it this week, and he comes from a very working class Irish immigrant background, and his house was full of books, and his mother was a huge fan of the theatre. So there's no straitjacket here. No one lives their life on rails. But as a general rule, we often think of culture as being a middle class enthusiasm, and probably in statistical terms, it is proportionately more likely to land in those sort of families than it is in others. So I am always interested by the things that helped you, the cultural experiences that genuinely changed your life, whether it's a music teacher or whether it's an experience or whether it's a whole sort of 2-year course with exposing you to stuff you never would have been otherwise exposed to. I'll explain a little bit more about that shortly. Staying on a cultural tip, we're introducing a new feature this hour. To be honest with you, it may sound a little odd, this new feature, unless you were listening to yesterday's programme. But Henry Riley will be joining us with his recommendations for the erotic novel of the week. It's a new feature. It's Henry's idea. He's very keen to bring you a recommendation every week now for the erotic novel of the week. Find out more about that and exactly what it is that I am talking about a little later this hour. I've got the shortest missing word round in history. Would you like to do this? You almost certainly know the answer to it already. If you don't, you're in for a bit of a chuckle. Louvre password. You remember the Louvre got robbed recently, the French, the Parisian Art Gallery. Louvre password for CCTV was blank. Louvre password for CCTV was blank. This, the art gallery where £88 million worth of euros, 88 million euros worth of jewels were recently stolen from that museum. What do you think the password was? Louvre password for CCTV was blank. Serious answers only, please. Although, if you were to submit a silly answer without knowing the correct answer, you'd be in with a pretty good chance of actually getting it right with the silly answer. But I want to get stuck in next to this conversation. You know how we talked yesterday, didn't we, about how if you were to teach misinformation, was it on Wednesday or was it yesterday when we were talking about how you would teach misinformation to children? And the one of the most obvious ways, or one of the easiest ways perhaps, was to show how two stories can be reported in two completely different ways. And there's a lovely example of that today. In one newspaper, you could read this headline. Huge step in the right direction. Arts leaders hail move to boost creative subjects in England schools. Right? And then if you were to tune into a different outlet, the one where Michael Gove used to work and which is still owned by Rupert Murdoch, you'd read Bridget Phillipson's reforms, the death blow to learning languages. Experts line up to criticise the Education Secretary's changes to school assessment measures. So if you're going to talk to Michael Gove and the lady who likes to describe herself as Britain's strictest headmistress, which isn't weird at all, then you will read a very negative account of what was announced by the Education Secretary this week. If, however, you wanted to pay attention to cultural figures ranging from, I don't know, Ed Sheeran right through to James Graham, the playwright, also a former Full Disclosure guest, Eddie Marsan, the actor who was just with us, also a former Full Disclosure guest, then you would find it greeted with rather more enthusiasm, because you either recognise the unmeasurable role that the arts can play in your life, or you don't. Other people to greet this positively include an alumnus of my old school called Anthony Gormley, who you may be familiar with because he created the Angel of the North. And if you go to a school like ours, then you are exposed to art and culture and theatre and music. We had our own symphony orchestra. I've told you before, we had a pack of beagles. I sometimes forget how utterly alien a school like ours is to people with no knowledge or understanding of it. So the funny stuff would be we have a pack of beagles, and they're not used for sort of, you know, experiments in the biology laboratories. They're used to do, I don't know what beagles do. It wasn't a society that I joined. I presume they chase things. So, I mean, tell me what your school had that other schools don't have. Okay, an 18-hole golf course. Also reputedly the site of one of the finest magic mushroom crops in the north of England, but I would know nothing about that. An 18-hole golf course. At what point does your jaw drop when I'm talking to you about a normal school where boys go from the age of 13 to 18, or at least to the boys who go there, it's normal? An 18-hole golf course. How shocked are you? Scale of 1 to 10? No. A pack of beagles. A purpose-built 19th century theatre. What's more shocking, the pack of beagles or the golf course? Probably the golf course, a proper 18-hole golf course. And then, what was the thing I started this little introduction with? The thing that shocked me most that we had, the thing that people find most surprising, probably the pack of beagles. Oh, the symphony orchestra. Well, other schools have an orchestra, right? But you don't wear white tie. The lead violinist doesn't walk onto the stage wearing a full white tie tailcoat and get cheered to the rafters by... Well, I'm not going to lie to you, that was another society I never joined, but it definitely happened. And that was school. That was school for me. So I could have joined a symphony orchestra. I could have played Hamlet. I'd never played Hamlet. I played Horatio. I could have been, I mean, you name it, to be honest. And so it was only when I got this job that I began to fully appreciate just how absurdly privileged that kind of experience is. And the fact that my facility with theatre, I can joke with Eddie about signing up for a drama course, and my facility with theatre was present in my life from the age of about 10 or 11. It was utterly normal for me. I go see Othello earlier this week. It will stay with me for the rest of my life. David Harewood's performance in particular, somehow bringing vulnerability to a character that ends up committing a terrible crime. Do you know what I've just done? I've just avoided a spoiler on something that was written in the 17th century. On the very unlikely grounds that you don't know what happens at the end of Othello, I've just kept a surprise from you, just in case somebody... You're welcome, Keith. Just in case... Anyway, spoiler alert, written in the late 17th century, probably? Early... later than that? Early 18... No, earlier. Early 60... Early 70... 1600. Lower. Where's Brucey when you need him? The other show I saw this week was Elf. I saw Elf last night, Elf the musical, and you always have this little danger. There's probably a German word for it. The more time that lapses in between witnessing something, the more your opinion can just dilute slightly. I won't tell you what show it was, it wouldn't be fair, but I came out of one Shakespeare performance last year thinking it was one of the best things I'd ever seen, and by the time I woke up the next morning, I thought it was mediocre. It had gone from 5 stars to 3 stars, just as it settled in my mind. It's why I didn't mention Othello to you earlier this week, until it's had time to settle in my mind, and I could tell you it's a tour de force, an absolutely masterful central performance, two central performances. It's very early 17th century, written in 1604, they reckon, but performed posthumously, or published posthumously. I said 17th century, I just got my little part in the 17th century a little bit wrong. Elf is magnificent. I don't know that I have ever seen a more joyous musical. I've never seen Billy Elliot on stage, but I don't know if I've ever seen a more joyous musical than Elf the Musical. It's on at the Aldwych, and if you get the chance to see it, see it. It's also got Sir Alid of Jones in it. Alid Jones of this parish, someone who I often see in the Classic FM studio. He plays George Hobbs. You know, the again, I'm worried about giving you spoilers from Elf, the dad figure in Elf. No spoilers. It's just beautiful. Absolutely wonderful. My 17-year-old, I look at her sometimes when I'm at the theatre, at a show, particularly concerts, actually. She looked 7. You know when you see the 7-year-old inside your teenager? I'm very blessed I don't have a stroppy teenager, but you see the 7-year-old that they used to be. If you can, and I know that the West End can be expensive, but if you want to introduce your children to the theatre, or you want to inject some pure Christmas joy into your family this winter, then seeing Elf, the musical at the Aldwych Theatre, would be the best advice I've given you all week. If not all year. Seriously, it's just utterly wild. I'd go again tonight. If you've got a spare ticket, I'll come with you. I'd go again tonight. I just came out of there on cloud 11, which is a reference for the people really paying attention to one of the lyrics in one of the songs in the musical. So, I like this list of people. James Graham, who grew up in a sort of former mining community in Nottinghamshire. Brian Cox, who grew up in a very... humble circumstances. They've both appeared on Full Disclosure, actually, in Scotland. Anthony Gormley, who hasn't been on Full Disclosure, but who went to my school, so would have had a very privileged childhood, all joining forces to praise the government for reintroducing, if you like, culture and the importance of creativity to the curriculum. The move has been met with overwhelming positivity, with one figure saying it could end the madness of the past decade. The madness of the past decade best summed up as just testing children on what they've managed to memorise and how much of it they can regurgitate, what they've managed to memorise yesterday and how much of it they can regurgitate today. So, here we go. What was it for you? 03456060973. The genuinely life-changing. Because this is why I worried about a little bit of inverse snobbery. If you've grown up steeped in it, you don't recognise the moments of significance, really. You don't recognise the moments of importance. But I want two things from you. I want to know what it was, what cultural input or experience changed your life and took you out of the circumstances you were raised in or born in, whatever it was, a musical instrument or one trip to the theatre that changed your life, that just changed the way you looked at everything. I'd love you to share that with me today on 03456060973. And then I want us together to have a crack at what difference does it make? If I were to get political about it, I would suggest that culture and empathy go together like a horse and carriage. That the only way I will ever know what it is like to be someone who's not me is through culture, really, isn't it? It's why the post office drama was so effective, so much more effective than pages and pages and pages of journalism and reporting. Brilliant journalism, brilliant reporting. But until they made the drama, starring Toby Jones, who's coming in to record Full Disclosure next week, it's almost as if every major cultural figure of our times has, or is about to record a Full Disclosure episode. Today's is a treat as well. But the post office drama landed in ways that the journalism and the investigations didn't land, because it took us into the minds of Mr. Bates, who got his settlement this week, seven-figure settlement, finally. Took us into the, you could imagine what it was like to be them. You can't, on a good day, we can do that together. Did it a bit in the last hour with the conversation about parents who were frightened of their children. But a drama does it better than we ever could. Theatre, drama, television, film does it better than we ever could. You get that idea of what it is like to be in the miners' strike in the 1980s or to grow up in hideous circumstances or to be, absolutely smitten by a kestrel or whatever it might be, those moments that give you an insight into another world that builds your capacity for empathy. You're seeing a political move in the world at the moment which almost denigrates empathy. It makes empathy a bad thing. Feeling sorry for people is a bad thing to do, because if you feel sorry for them, you might help them, and you can't further enrich the richest people on the planet if you're helping the poorest. So don't do it. Don't do empathy. So anyway, that's enough. I just want to know. Not big. Doesn't have to be like, oh, my, and now I'm an Oscar-winning actor, James. Nothing like that. You just know somehow that you'd be a different person today from the one that you are if it wasn't for art. Art, creativity and culture. The things that have helped to make you and what those things were. That's it. Two simple questions. What were those moments, those experiences, those encounters that changed you? And what changes did they make? Hit the numbers now, you will get through. 03456060973.
This is LBC. Listen on the move with the new LBC app.
When BP asked me to read the voiceover for their new Wild Bean Cafe ad, I thought I knew what to expect. But when they told me I'd be reading the script next to a mountain waterfall, on horseback, strumming a harp, in a hailstorm, naked, ow, 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 ow. Well, that was wildly unexpected. Just like Wild Bean Cafe having a freshly ground signature espresso blend for everything from Americanos to flat whites in a fuel station. Wowzers. Wild Bean Cafe. Only at BP. Subject to availability at selected BP stores only.
So, what's on your to-do list today? Why don't you check if you're eligible for pension credit? It tops up your pension income and also opens up help with heating bills, council tax, and more. Search pension credit on gov.uk or call 0800 99 1234. There's nothing to lose. Check today. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
Hillary's best ever Black Friday sale is now on, and it doesn't get any better than this. With an extra 10% off absolutely everything. That's on top of up to 50% off hundreds of made-to-measure blinds, curtains and shutters. Plus, control your blinds from anywhere with a half-price smart hub when you buy any electric blind, with measuring and fitting always included. And word to the window wise. Order now for blinds and curtains fitted in time for Christmas. Book your free in-home appointment today at Hillary's. Conditions apply.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
21 minutes after 12. Oh, I've remembered. Louvre password for CCTV was Louvre. I love this. The password for the Louvre's video surveillance system was simply Louvre when thieves stole jewels worth €88 million from the museum last month. The password for another security system operated by the defence contractor Thales, T-H-A-L-E-S, was... Yep, you got it. Thales, T-H-A-L-E-S. Until recently, some security installations were still running on an outdated Windows 2000 and Windows Server 2003 operating systems. I love that. I didn't get any correct... did I get any correct answers? My thing got a little bit overwhelmed by answers. Yeah, there were a couple of correct answers. I've got another missing word round for you, which is arguably even easier. Tice, as in the fellow who carries Nigel Farage's bags around, Tice appalled as school teachers' reform policies are close to blank. I'm going to give you a little clue. He's not appalled to discover that his party's policies are close to this thing. He's appalled to discover that a school is teaching that his party's policies are close to whatever this word is. Tice quotes, appalled, end quotes, as school teachers' reform policies are close to blank. What do you think that? What could the missing word in that sentence possibly be? Let's get back to culture and the life change. I think probably my favourite topic ever that we talk about together. I don't know why, but it's certainly in the top 10. Although, as Bob has pointed out, it did just lead to possibly my greatest Alan Partridge moment yet. I didn't, Bob, actually say, give me a call if you've ever been smitten by a kestrel. I did not say that. I was just running through in my head cultural moments involving characters and scenarios that I would have had no experience of myself. And Kez popped into my mind, so I said the phrase smitten by a kestrel, which I grant you sounds in isolation like quite a weird selection of words. But I did not, I'm pretty sure, invite people to ring in and tell me about the time they were smitten by a kestrel. All right? Smitten by a novel or a film about a kestrel, or about a boy who is smitten... Anyway, stop being mean. Steve's in Eastham in Worcestershire. Steve, what made you pick up the phone?
Hi, James. First-time caller.
Welcome, Steve.
Basically, James, I'm involved in music and drama in Evesham. I started playing the trumpet at 11 years old just to get out of my maths lesson.
Did they give you that? You could skip maths if you... I'd have taken up the trumpet if anyone had told me that.
Well, yeah, indeed. And it led to basically, James, me getting up to my grade 7 and being in my local silver band at Brepton Silver Band. And I love it to bits. And then I got into theatre because I used to be a Boy Scout and we did gang shows. And then we went on to pantomimes. But cut a long story short, I'm now a member of Evesham Operatic and Dramatic Society, where I met my wife 24 years ago.
Oh, I love it.
And
what's the show this year? What show are you doing, James, next?
Well, can I give a quick plug?
Yeah.
Week after next, my wife Alison, who's directing the show and producing it, our kids have been brought up with it as well. But it's Our House Madness Musical, week after next.
Are you in it?
Absolutely. I auditioned, but I didn't get the principal role.
Your wife is directing it. You auditioned for a leading role, and you ended up in the chorus.
No, well, my wife is very fair, and
either that or she just doesn't rate you.
And talking about education, James, she's actually a maths teacher.
Oh, I love it. This is really lovely.
So, her release is theatre. And we absolutely love it, James.
How?
My daughter's at York University doing musical theatre. My stepson is a professional musician. Absolutely, I'll tell you, I could talk to you about it all day.
I'm already picking up on that, Steve. Actually, you've gone from being a nervous first time caller to me struggling to get a word in edgeways in the space of about 30 seconds.
Yeah.
So briefly, if you would. How much? Who is Steve today? Which bits of Steve do you think might not have been there had you not discovered this at a young age?
I'd probably been a very shy, quite reserved. But now I'm a humbled painter and decorator, and I often say, I live to work. No, I live work to live.
I can see why she didn't give you the lead, mate. You've got to learn your lines better.
But Brilliant.
I love that.
Minute to anybody.
Yeah, yeah, and it's on at Isham Village Hall, is it? Where is it on?
No, Isham Art Centre, which is called the Henrikian.
In the Malvern Hills, beautiful part of the world. Just sort of...
that's right.
So get yourself down there. That's a great show as well. And obviously you'll be able to spot Steve. He's the one looking cross in the background about the fact that he didn't get the lead right. I'm joking. It'll be a lovely... And that there you go. You know what I'm talking about. You don't need me to explain it any further. Nitin is in St. Neots. Nitin, what would you like to say?
Hi, it's Nitin. I'm just... first of all, very nervous. My first time call up. Massive fan.
So you're a professional performer. How can you be nervous talking to me?
Well, I just am, because I'm a huge fan of yours, you know.
You're very kind.
Yeah, I was no GCSEs, you know, plodding along in school, sort of loved being there, but didn't like any of the learning, really. And then all of a sudden, you know, at the age of 17, just trying not to go to college, trying to stay in sixth form at my school because all my mates were there. Yeah. And then I walked into a new performing arts course that's about to start for the first time. They were piloting it around the country, 2-year course. And I just walked in saying, any chance of an audition? I'd like to maybe try out. And they almost laughed me out of the room. Everyone was like, no, we're not having you in here. Bloody hell, this is like everyone's watching us around the country. You know, we need this to work. And I was like, oh, go on, let me just try something, you know. And Jackie Warwicker, one of the drama teachers, said, let Nitin try it. And they're like, he hasn't done GCSE drama, he's done nothing. And anyway, they told me to go away and learn this bit of Shakespeare. I can't remember what it was at this stage, but whatever it was, they asked me to go away and learn it and look at it. And I came back and did it, and they were all looking at each other. Now, in my head, it was like the X Factor, where they all look at each other and, you know, they tell me to leave the room, and they say, what a natural, you come back in to press the golden buzzer, all that. It wasn't quite that, but it was, in my head, it was that, you know. But anyway, they let me on the course for 2 years, you know, and then next thing you know, I'm at the Edinburgh Fringe performing Blood Wedding. I'm playing Leonardo, like the lead in that, and, you know, to the dismay of a lot of the sort of A-star GCSE drama students, you know, I'm just walking in there.
What did you get out of it that you hadn't got anywhere else in life before?
It just completely transformed my life. I mean, I couldn't put a sentence together in terms of, I wasn't interested. All of a sudden, I'm writing, you know, like I'm writing about the performance sort of, you know, after you do the play or whatever, you know, you write about the actual process, and my pencil would just break, you know, my hand would ache because I'm just writing page after page. And Jackie, you know, she used to have to say, you know, you have to read this out to me because I can't understand a bloody word you've written here. But when I would do it, you know, I ended that course with a distinction. I auditioned for drama schools and I ended up going to Middlesex University, and I ended up going there for 3 years, and all of a sudden I'm in London, you know, from Newcastle. And the year before, on my record of achievement, I've written, you know, work in Top Shop. That's what I did. That's all I hope to do, you know, work in Top Man or something like that, work in retail, because my dad was a market trader on the market stalls and we sold clothes. And that's all I ever wanted, you know, that's all I thought I'd ever do. But just like that, out of nowhere.
That's mad.
The love of it.
That's incredible.
And then I'm in London, and then before you know it, I've got an agent and I've done 15, 16 TV shows. I've been to the National Theatre several times. I've performed there a lot. And then just to kind of just round it up for you, James, Jackie Warwicker, that drama teacher that I'm talking about, in 2018, I did a play at the Park Theatre in Finsbury Park called Alkaline. And again, I was one of the leads in that. And then Jackie came to watch the play, and the first time I've seen her. I've name-checked her in local press stuff over the years. Oh. I've done a TV drama. I've always name-checked her, and she's never thought for my thoughts because life transformed because of that lady. But then all of a sudden, she came to watch my show. And she told me how proud she was after this. She's there with her husband and her daughter, you know, and we're sort of shaking hands, and I'm being all very professional. And I went off in between the matinee and the evening performance, and we all sat in an Italian restaurant having a meal. And everyone's going to me, are you okay? You're not your normal self. And I'm like, I didn't really tell Jackie what I wanted to say there, you know. And I was like, guys, do you mind just
speaking?
I was just on the corner from the theatre. I just got up and I just left. And luckily, I ran to the theatre, and luckily, she was still out there having a drink with her family. And I said, and I just, I mean, I'm getting emotional now even thinking about it. I just turned into a quivering wreck. And I said, thank you very much. You don't know what you mean to me. And I gave her a big cuddle. And I was shaking. And she held me for about a minute. And she's like, you don't have to say thank you. You know, she's a retired drama teacher, bless her. And I'm overwhelming her here with. And I think it's just important for people like her to know what they do. And that's why, you know, when Eddie was talking earlier on about giving it a go, I urge anyone. Look, I'm a working class boy. My mum's a care worker. My dad worked in the market stores. I'm from Newcastle. Like, I'm brown. You know what I mean? You just don't expect these things to happen. There's no sort of access to it. But I feel like if you want to do it, you know, my only access was watching Bollywood movies with my mum when I was a young boy.
Wow.
But, you know, like, access to anything different. I didn't go to the theatre. I had no interest in it. I didn't know I could do it. That's the point. And you don't know until you kind of try these things.
And if you'd gone to a school like mine, you'd have been told from a very, very early age that you can do anything you want.
Do anything you want, exactly.
It's mad, isn't it?
Lost on me when I listen to you talking about that stuff, you know. And my journey's never lost on me, you know. And I don't act anymore, but look, I work in film advertising now. And tomorrow I'm off to LA. Do you know what I mean?
It's not a bad old life.
It's not a bad old life.
Obviously, just to be clear, you're behind the camera when it comes to advertising, because we don't want people like you in adverts, Nitin. There's a few politicians.
I've done a lot of adverts over the years.
There are a few politicians that it upsets too much.
You know what? I can't tell you how much that affected me. I mean, just slightly changes. I was racially abused at Finsey Park train station on my way back to St. Nate's about a month and a bit ago.
Wow.
You know, you can hear my accent. I was absolutely shocked. And then all this stuff since then about, you know, what you're reading about these sort of reform people talking about me. I've done a Christmas advert for Co-op, a Halloween advert for Co-op. I've done several adverts for massive brands, you know what I mean? And I'm thinking, she's literally trying to pick my pocket here. If she has her way, you know what I mean? All them nice little paydays that I had, all them bloody hundreds of auditions I've been for adverts that I haven't got, I got five or six in the end, and, you know, you get them, and then I paid it. But it's just ridiculous, you know, it's just such a strange thing for a person to say, to even notice.
A deeply strange thing to say, and even stranger to describe yourself as being driven mad by people like you doing your job well, doing your job successfully.
You know, especially when I feel so English, that's the point. I mean, you don't get any more English than me. Do you know what I mean? Like, I support England and everything that they do, and I've got this show, you know, I'm from Newcastle, and all my mates would say it too, you know, but they say, well, we're not talking about you. We're talking about the new ones that are coming. And that's where I just can't stand it, because it's like, but my mum was the new one. My dad was the new one in the late 60s. They were the new ones coming in. So you don't, and that's why I hate the people who want to push the ladder down. Sorry, I know I'm going on a bit of a rant here, but...
You're in good company, Nitin.
I've not called you ever before, but I've always had these thoughts. And I never called James. I've got so much...
So you're trying to squeeze in every call you could have made over the last 10 years into one call. I know. Well, we'll talk again.
All the best. Really appreciate you listening to me.
God bless.
All the best. Cheers. Bye.
Cheers, Nitin. See you later. He was, wasn't he? It was like 10 different shows there he was contributing to. And I loved it. Here's Tim Humphrey with the headline.
The sex offender freed in error from Wandsworth Prison has been arrested. Brahim Kador Sharif was detained in the Finsbury Park area of London at 11:30 this morning. Julia Van Delt, who claimed to be Madeleine McCann, has been found guilty of harassing the missing girl's parents, but the 24-year-old Polish national has been cleared of stalking Kate and Jerry McCann. Her co-defendant, Karen Spragg, was cleared of both charges. Two people have been arrested after an XL bully dog killed a baby in South Wales. The 9-month-old boy was attacked on Sunday. The pair have been bailed. LBC weather, some bright intervals this afternoon, but showers in many places with heavier rain in the southwest, a high of 15 degrees.
This is LBC.
Whether you're managing a business or a football club, your team are your biggest strength. But when it comes to cybersecurity, they could also be your biggest weakness. 88% of cybersecurity breaches are caused by normal human error. So how do you help your team form the ultimate impenetrable line of defense? Just ask BT.
How's the business going?
We're busier than ever, but struggling to get the staff we need.
Recruiting can be such a distraction. We gave Job Centre Plus a try, and they've really helped us out.
Really?
Yeah, it was dead easy. We got our own employer advisor, Julie, who helps advertise our jobs, shortlisted candidates for us and let us interview at the job centre. We've hired some great people, and Job Centre Plus really took the hassle out of it, and there was no fee.
Brilliant. That's straight on my to-do list.
Find out more at business.gov.uk/recruit. Eligibility criteria apply.
At Lathwaite, we go to great lengths to bring you great wine. We go far and wide, searching high, and we mean really high, and low, and we mean stored deep underground in a cave low. Off the shelf? We don't go there. Off the beaten track? We certainly go there. And the best bit is, we even come to you. Order now at lathwaites.co.uk. Lathwaites. We stop at nothing to bring you great wine.
The £5 meal deal from McDonald's. Get a cheeseburger or mayo chicken, medium fries, 4 McNuggets and a medium soft drink for guess what? That's right, £5. It's not called the £5 meal deal for nothing. From 11 a.m. Not available on delivery. Carbonated soft drink upgrade fees apply. Participating restaurants subject to availability.
You asked, BT answered.
Keeping your team cyber aware is really important in the modern marketplace.
Regular training on things like data handling, spotting threats, and securing the devices helps you keep them and your business safe.
Cybersecurity is everyone's business. Search BT Business Cybersecurity to find out more.
This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
It is 12:36, and I've just remembered that I got I met one of the fathers of one of the performers in Elf. So the role of the little boy is rotated because of equity rules. Children can only perform a fixed number of hours a week. So there's four lads, I think, rotating the role. And the dad of one of them came up to me last night and asked me to give his boy a shout out. And I was trying to find them in the interval so I could ask the little boy for his autograph. I thought that would have been quite a fun thing to do, but I couldn't find them. So a big shout out and break a leg, which is what we thespians say to each other. That's how we actors wish each other luck, you see. So break a leg, Harry. That's Harry Georgiou, who is playing the role of the son in Elf the Musical at the moment at the Aldwych Theatre. Stay safe, Harry. I get quite a lot of odd requests on this programme. Henry Riley was on the show yesterday bringing us up to date with the latest shenanigans at Kent County Council. And I don't quite understand, well, I do know why, but I'll let Henry explain. He came up to me afterwards and asked if we could launch a new feature on the programme, which would be Henry Riley's recommendation for Erotic Novel of the Week. I think we should probably explain the genesis of this idea, Henry.
Well, I'm grateful for you giving me this platform, firstly, James. It means a lot. If people didn't catch the conversation, the reason we're talking about erotic novels, let me just remind them, this was one of the kicked-out reform councillors, Robert Ford, speaking before their meeting yesterday.
So I wrote an email to my colleagues addressing the bullying happening around us in KCC. I knew I would face consequences for this, but I was prepared for that. What followed, however, shocked me. I'm currently taking legal advice regarding defamation of my character by KCC, by Reform UK and KCC that occurred on October the 13th. I intend in the coming months to pursue this with vigour. A few days ago, I discovered so-called complaints against me, all relating to my novel writing. It's astonishing that my name can be defamed simply because I wrote an erotic novel and got it published by a major company. And I then mentioned it to a few people in the building behind me. It's a shame that our great nation has come to this. Thank you.
Well, I mean, who can possibly disagree that someone, the great nation, the decline of the UK is perfectly encapsulated by the reception his erotic novel received from his Reform UK colleague?
Yeah, that's Robert Ford,
a well-known erotic novelist. So I charged you yesterday with finding out a little bit more about this erotic novel.
And we've got it. This is, oh no, this is R.W. Mitson, Diaries of a Colourful Life.
I told you it would be a nom de plume.
Yeah, no, you were right, actually. I mean, in fact, before I read you a little bit, let me tell you about the author, which is, we get this on the Waterstones website. I'm an adventurer who's climbed over 17 mountains, including the highest mountain of Bulgaria, which is Marsala, which I didn't know,
right.
Slovenia, Slovakia, three mountains in Switzerland. The highest mountain I've climbed is Chukking Ree in the Himalayas. He's also a scuba diver all over the world. In 2008...
It's not Steve Baker in disguise, is it?
In 2008, while skydiving...
Fast catamaran. Is there any fast catamaran sailing on this CV?
Trained in martial arts for over 20 years. I've done Wutan and Zhengdao. And kickboxing.
It didn't sound like that, did he, in the clip?
No.
I don't know what you'd expect someone with that kind of track record to sound like. Possibly Steven Seagal.
Wouldn't have put him down for it, would you?
No.
Let me read you a little bit of the book.
Yeah. It's a family programme.
This is Diaries of a Colourful Life. On one of our weekend sailing trips, we were sailing around Beachy Head in East Sussex on the south coast of England. Being a sunny day, I looked out of the crystal ball and there was water shimmering in the sunlight. With Jim at the wheel, we were half asleep watching the huge white cliffs go by. There's a lot of clouds building up at sea. Jim could be a storm brewing. This is verbatim, by the way.
Is he doing speech now?
Yes.
Is he doing accent?
Sorry. What sort of accent?
No, I'm not.
There is a storm brewing there.
You said to Eddie Marsden, you've got to be very careful these days. I'm not. I went inside to make a cuppa, listening to a different radio station. A song by Ava Max had just come on the radio, Sweet But Psycho. It reminded me of my ex. Suddenly, out of the blue, the storm was on top of us so quickly, it exploded all around us. A barbaric ambush of nature, towering waves swallowing the boat up in suffocating gulps, one after the other. The kettle flew across the cooker, hitting the wall.
It's not very erotic. It's not very erotic.
With an almighty bang. It's the only bit I can find.
Can we cut to the dirty
bit? Well, let me tell you what I've got.
See where the book falls open when you hold it in the palm of your hand.
I have ordered a copy, but it hasn't arrived yet. The book description. This is the meat of the bone.
Okay.
After Rob, and by the way, Rob is also the name, not suggesting that the character is based on him, but Rob is the name of the counsellor.
The real name of the author is Rob.
It's real.
And the hero of the book is called Rob.
It's called
Rob.
But
the author of the book is not called Rob. So you can't read anything into any of this.
Yes. After Rob's failed relationship with his fiancée Jenny and a string of terrible hookups, he decides to take a trip of a lifetime around the world. He teams up with his best friend Jim, who himself has split up with his on-off girlfriend Natalie a few weeks earlier. It all leaves a bad taste in their mouths and a somewhat questionable attitude towards women that shows through in this graphic portrayal of sex, drugs and adventure through the eyes of Rob.
Wow.
He doesn't pull any punches, showing arrogance with violent tendencies. They treat women they meet with contempt at times.
What? And he's a reform politician.
The author
is a reform, resigned.
Yes.
Dismissed or resigned? I can't remember.
Resigned. He's now an independent reformist, Kent. They treat women they meet with contempt, while at times Rob's sure character tries to break free from his pain of losing Jenny. And the book, I mean, it's by Pegasus Publishers, who they also do Paul Harcastle's book, you know,
19.
And I'll give you a couple of reviews. The proofreader says the sex scenes are very well written and engaging.
Well, we're going to have to take their word for it, because you read us a bit about a kettle.
I know, but that's all I could find. Waterstones gives it 4.5 stars after 6 reviews online. There are 2 5-star reviews on Amazon. Trisha says it's an absolutely fantastic book.
The Trisha?
That's the headline of it. I don't know if it's the Trisha, but it's an absolutely fantastic book. Some of the most compelling and vivid adult scenes I've ever read. His writing is truly unique. It showcases a personal style that sets him apart from the rest. This book is a joy to read. And then I've got one more review from Jenny, who says, "Be warned, this book will devour hours of your life. I dove into this book with a heavy dose of scepticism, convinced I was going to hate it, racing through the rich tapestry the story wove, savouring the very well-written sex scenes, and added depth to the story without hijacking it." And it's currently £12.99 on Amazon or £11.49 on worldofbooks.com.
Well, I hope he feels that we have helped restore national pride by treating this tome with the respect that it deserves.
I have gone to him for a comment as well. But I have not received one.
Okay.
But just to confirm, it's
and you could perhaps get him to sign your copy while you're at it. And that is the first episode of Henry Reilly's Erotic Novel of the Week recommendation.
Back next week.
Any thoughts on what might pop up next?
There's a few. I mean, yeah. I'm open to ideas.
I did one thing I forgot to tell you. They have to be written by reform politicians.
Oh, okay, right. Yeah. Let's hope Edwina Curried affects to reform. That might give me week 2.
That's Doris, is there?
Oh, that's true, yeah. Oh, yes.
We might actually get 2 weeks
out. No.
It's at 12:45.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
They hold you in disdain. The lawyer for the families of Southport victims BB Alice and Elsie to Axel Rudigabana's father speaks to LBC. Plus, guilty of harassing the McCann family. But why did she do it?
Sheila Fogarty at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or our new LBC app.
Things are really heating up in the country's smallest house.
Dad!
Squealed Mia Mouse.
We could save around £100 by setting the boiler flow temperature to 60 degrees.
And turning radiators down in rooms we don't use.
Interrupted Mo.
Yes, Mo.
Turn them down.
Not off,
said Mia.
Plus finding and blocking drafts,
said Mo.
Should save enough to increase our allowance.
A little saves a lot. You could save around £100 a year off your energy bills with 3 tips at gov.uk/cleanenergy.
Managing your business is a big task. To then stay on top of the numbers as well, you're only human. That's why the Intuit QuickBooks AI-powered platform supports your business growth as the number one recommended cloud accounting software. Intuit QuickBooks. based on a survey of 506 UK accounting professionals. Verify at quickbooks.co.uk/verify.
Great to see you back at Specsavers. Okay, could you read out the letters on the wall for me?
Yep. D-E-A-L-S? Yeah, D-E-A-L-S. Deals.
Oh, right. Our Black Friday deals are eye-catching, but the letter chart's over here.
Oh, sorry.
At Specsavers, we've got all sorts of unmissable Black Friday deals, like up to £50 off one pair of designer glasses. Offer ends on 7th of December 2025. Conditions apply. Ask in store for details.
At Lathwaite, we go to great lengths to bring you great wine. We go far and wide. Searching high, and we mean really high, and low, and we mean stored deep underground in a cave low. Off the shelf? We don't go there. Off the beaten track, we certainly go there. And the best bit is, we even come to you. Order now at Lathwaites.co.uk. Lathwaites. We stop at nothing to bring you great wine.
At TfL, we're making tube journeys faster in the future, with signalling improvements underway on the Circle, District, Hammersmith and City and Metropolitan lines. And there's also the Elizabeth line, already giving you fast journeys across central London. That is how we're making the greener way to travel brighter for everyone. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Elizabeth line is fast compared to other TfL modes. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
Leading Britain's conversation, LBC, with James O'Brien.
12:47. Just in case there's any confusion at all about why I referenced hard man of Brexit, Steve Baker, when Henry was running through the extraordinarily daredevil CV of this week's star of erotic novel of the week by a Reform UK politician by Henry Riley. This is why.
Skydiving, motorcycling, fast catamaran sailing.
Steve Baker there somewhat presciently describing what he was likely to be doing after losing or leaving his seat in Parliament. I don't know that we can. I've just spotted a problem in that series, Eleanor. So we've done that one, and then next week we'll probably get something from Nadine Dorries. But what if there aren't any more Reform UK politicians who've written erotic novels? What if we're only going to have two episodes of the whole feature? This is going to be worse than Pope Watch, where we only really had one. Poor old Henry's desperately trying to get on the big show. And he comes up with all these ideas. Pope Watch, which was when I would get him on to ask whether any smoke had appeared at the Vatican. And before we'd even finished the first day of Pope Watch, the smoke had appeared at the Vatican and the poor fellow had to go back to the drawing board. And now he's come up, maybe he's got kind of prophetic skills or prophetic tendencies. Now he's come up with this great new idea, erotic novel of the week by a Reform UK politician starring Henry Riley. But there may only be two. And I don't even know how erotic Nadine Dorries' novels are. And I'm going to be honest with you, as I say those words out loud, I realise I really don't want to know. But it's too late now. The hair is running. Join us next week for Henry Riley's recommendation of erotic novel of the week by a Reform UK politician starring Henry Riley. Leanne's in Letchworth. I've almost taught myself out of the appreciation of culture that we began this hour with, Leanne, and I'm thinking that I may never want to read another book again. But what prompted you to pick up the phone in the first place?
Hi, James.
Hello, Leanne.
Long-time listener, huge fan, but first-time caller.
Thank you.
Have never found the time. I've always got my kids around me, or I'm doing something else. Thought I'll never get through, but I've stayed on the line. I had a couple while you were talking to that wonderful guy from Newcastle before.
Oh, lovely.
Oh, my gosh, he was just my kind of person. So, I was a very, very shy child. And when I say shy, I mean painfully shy.
Gosh.
I'm the youngest of six. Everybody's much older than me, and I just didn't find my flow until I watched both my sisters in a production of Godspell at their performing arts high school.
Wow.
This was a performing arts high school in the middle of a council estate in Leeds, which I'm from Leeds. Very humble beginnings. It was lottery funded.
Gosh.
They created this way back. I mean, I'm 45 now. I went in, 1992?
Yeah.
To year seven. You auditioned. It cost you £30 to audition, which was a lot of money then for my parents. But I auditioned. I got the bug. I got in. And instead of PSHE, I did drama. And we did it all through drama. Instead of PE, I went to dance. I should say dance. I'm going to get told off for that by my lovelies, because I've been down in London longer than I was there. But I sucked it all in.
Changed your life.
Wonderful.
Genuinely changed your life.
Completely changed my life. So I stayed there from year 7 to year 13. And let me put this out. This is like the Brit School up north, but there are no fees.
Okay.
whatsoever. You just go to the school, you do your mainstream school. I still got my 12 GCSEs, I still got my 5 A-levels. I went on then to audition for a drama school, having been... I went to university, but they cancelled the course. And last minute, so I went for a scholarship audition. I got it. I went to the Guildford School of Acting. I did 3 years on musical theatre there, got an agent, worked for 15 years in the West End. I've toured internationally with Mamma Mia. I've been on the West End with Terry Johnson in La Cage aux Folles. Buddy, Holly the Musical. Buddy. That's my son in the background. Footloose, Grease. You know, I've done the cruise ships. I've been on The Crown. I've done advert, voiceovers.
Oh, fantastic.
Everything you could possibly think of. And I've got to do a big shout out to Mr. Key, the drama teacher, and Mr. and Mrs. Robbins, the music and dance teacher. There were many other, Mr. Connell, Miss Bailey. Oh my gosh, I could go on and on and on. All the teachers.
And even now, everyone can hear it in your voice. It's Robert Frost's poem, isn't it? It's The Path Not Taken. You took the one less travelled by, and that has made all the difference.
And my mum couldn't believe it. She's like, hang on a minute.
You can't do this.
Where's my
shy little wallflower?
I'm only 5'3", I'm tiny. And she sort of said, what do you mean you're moving to London? I'm off to Guildford. I'm off.
And
everyone talked different to me, but it worked because everyone, you know, loved the Yorkshire accent and it worked in my favour. And I had 15 glorious, glorious years on the stage, on TV. And now I'm a drama teacher. I still gig with a band every now and then, but I'm a drama
passing on to the next generation. So it will be you that is cited 20 years from now by somebody who looks back upon a wonderful career of performing. And it is that thing. It's so weird. So weird to get the little nod, that little door, that door that is ajar, and then you can push through it. But if it is not ajar, then what can you do? 12:52 is the time. Somebody with a CV that is arguably even more impressive than Leanne's is the producer John Lloyd. Check this out for a list of things to be associated with or to have brought to the screen. Blackadder, Not the 9 o'clock News, Spitting Image, all the Blackadders, QI, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Doctor Who, The Lost Stories, Blackadder's Christmas Carol, QI being his sort of labour of love now. And he is somebody who absolutely deserves all of the plaudits that he's received, but who provided me with one of the most unexpectedly joyful full disclosures I've ever done, because he goes really deep. He really looks into, as you'd expect from a former collaborator of Douglas Adams, he is really interested in the meaning of life, albeit that he was with me to promote the Dictionary of Words That Don't Exist But Should, which he wrote with Douglas Adams many years ago and is now being re-released to mark its anniversary, The Meaning of Lif, with two Fs. But here is a little clip of John Lloyd being amazing. You'd shared a flat, I think, with Douglas Adams after leaving Cambridge, is that right? And
yeah.
You reconnected, I think, around about this time, around about the time that Rowan Atkinson came into your life. And he was working on Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. He was struggling to finish it, so you stepped into that breach, I think.
Yeah, it was good. We were best friends. We were genuinely as close of friends as you can be. So it was great, and we'd written together a lot. It was an obvious thing. He got stuck. Of course I held the art. It was no problem. We knocked the whole thing off in 3 weeks. It was really good fun. And then when it became very successful, he thought the better of it and, you know, gave me the elbow. And that was an awful moment.
That was very hurtful.
Very, very hurtful. And I was very, very angry. But
did you reconcile?
Yeah. We'd booked a month in Corfu to write the start
writing
series.
Was he contrite?
No. He never couldn't understand what I was cross about. So he's pleased when you know, I've sort of, okay, well, let's go. I didn't have any money, so he sat and was the great novelist in the big hat, and I was in the bar, you know, and eventually he'd give up and come down to the bar, and this is where The Meaning of Lif came from.
Who had the idea first? Did you do the game? Did you do work?
Yeah, was a game.
I presumed you did.
It was a game that his old English master at school used to play, you know, at the end of term or in a spare period or something. He'd say, you know, what's an Ely? What do you think an Ely is? And what's Epping mean? So that's where it came from. An Ely, of course, is the first tiniest inkling that something somewhere has gone terribly wrong. Oh, we've got a little Ely there. And there's a lot of... So Epping is the fruitless movements of forefingers and eyebrows when failing to attract the attention of a waiter or barman. That's Epping. Woking is standing in the kitchen wondering what you came in here for. There are lots of ING ones. Kettering. Yes. The marks left on your bottom and thighs after sitting sunbathing on a wickerwork chair.
That's powerful.
The thing is, you look back on your life, and I think at the time, Douglas giving me the sack as my best friend was the worst thing that ever happened, probably, emotionally.
Yes.
But now I think, oh boy, was I lucky, because I would have otherwise been the guy, who's that dude who works with Douglas Adams? Jeremy thing? What is he? I would have been that. I would have been the acolyte. And this book, you know, The Meaning of Live, it used to come in a little tiny black thing, like a prayer book. That was Douglas's idea, with just gold lettering on it. And it's not infrequent in my life that people will say to me, say in an advertising meeting, they'll say, well, we've got this idea. Do you know a book called The Meaning of Live? And I would go, yes, I wrote it. Did you? And they pull the little thing out, and there's my name on it, same size as Douglas Adams, but they had never noticed it. And the beauty of the, you know, I have this saying, James, again, it's something to live by, disaster is a gift, okay?
Yes.
Because things that happen to you that are terrible at the time, very often, 20 years later, you go, oh, thank goodness I didn't marry that person, because that would have been a terrible disaster, the person who... And the same with Douglas, is that Douglas giving me the boot, it kicked me out of my torpor, to go, and I'm going to make something of myself.
There's another bit where he talks about the first time he saw Rowan Atkinson on stage, when Rowan Atkinson was a student who'd started off in a troupe with six or seven other students taking a show from, I think, Oxford University to the Edinburgh Festival. And by the time they got to the stage, Rowan Atkinson was such a perfectionist, he'd got rid of six of them. There were only two people left, but John Lloyd, who kind of made Rowan Atkinson a star, knew that he was in the presence of something truly. It's just a really, really lovely interview. If, like me, you've been a fan of comedy during any of the last 30 or 40 years, then you will find something there to absolutely delight you. And speaking of disaster being a gift, Councillor Robert Ford has been in touch. The author of this week's recommendation from Henry Riley of Erotic Novels of the Week, written by Reform UK politicians. And he has confirmed that he is indeed the author, albeit that he used a nom de plume. Main character is called Rob, but not the author. And he said, I've just been listening to you, which is weird, isn't it? They all do. I can't imagine why. It must be a form of masochism. And I can confirm that I wrote Diaries of a Colourful Life. I would like to thank you for the advertising of my novel. What I'd really like to know, Robert, is whether or not you feel that our warm words about your erotic novel have helped you address your fears about the state of the nation that you felt were encapsulated in the way that it had been greeted by your former colleagues in Reform UK. Anyway, don't forget to tune in next week for Henry Riley's second erotic novel of the week by a Reform UK politician feature. That is it from me for today. So apologies to Rob and Tony, Vanessa. Listen, I do this topic a lot. I promise I'll come back to it, to John and Geraldine and Alison, because I love it, and I think you know why. But don't worry, I will have time for all the stories before I finally retire to become an actor. If you miss any of today's show, you can listen back on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app, where you can stay up to date on the top stories and opinions. You can put your news categories in the order you want. You can pause. You can rewind live radio. You can listen to a range of podcasts, including Full Disclosure featuring John Lloyd this week. Download the official LBC app for free from your app store now. Tom Sawbrick will be with you at 4 on LBC, but now it's time for Sheila Fogarty.
Thank you very much, James. At 3 today, Andrew, you know the one, has been summoned by the US Congress to answer questions about Jeffrey Epstein, but will he go? At 2,
Malcolm Mistry, who was involved in the research, says that the aged pregnant people, women...
It wasn't the words, it was the exasperated facial expression, apparently, that saw a complaint against that presenter, Martin Croxall, upheld as an eye roll, an opinion. The BBC thinks so. Straight up after the news, though, I'll be joined by a lawyer representing the Southport attackers' victims' families. The father of the attacker tells the inquiry he shouldn't have concealed the seriousness of his son's violence. What should flow from that?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
from Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock. An Algerian sex offender released in error from Wandsworth prison in London has been arrested. Brahim Kader Sharif was picked up this morning in the Finsbury Park area of the city. LBC's Fraser Knight is following the story.
Real questions not only for the prison authorities but also for the government around how on earth this happened. Those questions still continuing to be asked. But finally, that manhunt for Brahim Kader Sharif over as he was arrested this morning.
Two women have been found not guilty of stalking the family of missing Madeleine McCann. 24-year-old Julia Vandelt from Poland had claimed to be Madeleine, sending a barrage of texts, emails and calls to the family. And her co-defendant, 61-year-old Karen Sprague from Cardiff, joined her on a trip to the McCann's home in Leicestershire to confront the family. Vandelt, who has been found guilty of harassment, recorded her calls to publish online as part of her evidence, including this one when Jerry McCann answered the phone.
Hello, who's speaking?
Hello, I'm Julia. Can we talk, please? I don't want to disturb you. I just need to talk with you.
You must have the wrong number.
No, I know your voice, Jerry.
61-year-old Karen Sprague has also been cleared of harassment. Three men have been charged with murder following the death of an inmate at Wakefield Prison. 33-year-old Carl Bevan, who was convicted of murdering a child, was found in his cell on Wednesday morning. The three are due to appear at Leeds Magistrates Court this morning. Two boys, aged 16 and 17, have been arrested after armed police were called to a college in Reading where a student was injured in an attack. The victim, who is in his late teens, has been discharged from hospital after suffering injuries in the assault at Reading College yesterday afternoon. Shares in ITV have jumped by more than 10% after it revealed talks of a sale of its media and broadcast division to Sky. Any agreement would include the TV channels and its streaming platform and values them at around £1.6 billion. The sale, though, would not include ITV Studios, which makes the likes of I'm a Celebrity and Mr Bates versus the Post Office. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 73 points at 96.63. The pound buys $1.31 and €1.13. And the LBC weather, some bright intervals this afternoon, but showers in many places with heavier rain in the southwest and a high of 15 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Tim Humphrey.
Every investor has a future in mind, whether it's seeing your kids through uni or picturing yourself retiring in Tuscany. The hard part can be knowing how to get there. JP Morgan Personal Investing can help you see the path ahead. With our intuitive app, expert support, and 150 years of JP Morgan's investing experience, you can start making more informed investment decisions today. Search JP Morgan Personal Investing. Invest with clarity. Capital at risk.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello there, good afternoon to you. The evidence heard yesterday at Liverpool Town Hall as part of the inquiry into the Southport murders and the attack last summer must have been absolutely shattering for the parents of Elsie Dot Stancombe, B.B. King and Alicia De Silva Aguiar, the three little girls who were murdered on that day. You know, many others were injured as well and many others traumatised as well as their families, and an awful lot of us just seeing it from the sidelines as well. A dreadful picture was painted of the attacker and his home life and his family and his bullying of his family and his threats to his family. His father, Alphonse, said in the hearings yesterday he accepted his share of responsibility for his son's actions. He said he didn't oversee his internet activity because he was afraid of him, and he didn't report the seriousness of the descent into violence of his son. The inquiry heard a bit about that bullying and that behaviour this week from the attacker's father, Alphonse Rudigabana. He gave evidence about how his son poured a significant quantity of oil, to use his words, over his head and threatened to kill him in 2024, not long before the attacks took place in Southport. Here are Mr. Rudigabana's words, voiced by an actor.
His eyes were very red, and it seemed like he had some kind of mental anguish, some kind of mental pain. He was poking my chest and saying, "If you get me out of here, this house, it may take a day, a week, or it may be years. I will kill you, and trust me, I will kill you."
Well, I'm joined by Chris Walker, a lawyer with Bond Turner, representing the families of Elsie Dotstankham, BB King and Alistair Silva Aguiar, who were murdered in that Southport attack in 2024. And just so our listeners know, Mr. Walker, the families have asked for the killer to be known as AR during our conversation, as he was referred to in the inquiry, is referred to in the inquiry. Thank you for joining me today. We'll certainly honour that for the families. You heard up close what the father, mother and brother of the killer said in the inquiry. What impact has that had, first of all, on the families?
Yes, well, thank you for inviting me. The parents made an apology yesterday, and from listening to the evidence, it was quite clear to me that their apology and the context to their apology was simply not credible. And consequently, the families have rejected that apology. It was certainly within the parents' power, as well as the various state agencies' power, to have prevented the attack. And they cannot fathom, nor can any reasonable, right-minded person fathom, how they did not report him to the police, did not engage with the various agencies, because if they had done so, the attack would not have occurred.
In previous incidents, he had been apprehended by the police. He was reported missing, wasn't he, sometime before, a good while before, and was apprehended by the police, had a weapon on him, said he would kill people. What flowed from that moment, long before the attack happened?
It's quite clear in my mind that there was a pivotal point, a pivotal opportunity to prevent the whole attack and the descent into manic chaos thereafter. In 2022, March, he was reported missing by his parents, and he was found on a bus with a knife, and his intention was to stab people because in his depraved mind, he was intending to have embarrassing social media posts removed, and he thought this was a way that that could occur. The police decided not to arrest him. They returned him home. They were treating it as a mental health issue. And during the journey home, he made a confession that he was intending to stab people and he had made poison. Now, the context of that is he'd already received a sentence for assault with a weapon, during which time he was also carrying a knife. And he admitted he intended to use that knife during that criminal conviction.
That was an attack incident. In school, is that right?
It was, yes.
Yeah.
And I cannot fathom why, upon hearing that confession, given the context which was available to the police if they'd object, Lancashire police, they did not arrest him. They conceded they should have arrested him, but didn't do so. Now, further, at that particular time, in January 22, he'd purchased the necessary materials, chemical equipment, chemistry equipment to create ricin, poison. And it seems to me that that had been developed in his bedroom. If the police, upon hearing that confession, had arrested him, we've heard how they would have searched his room. They would have found the ricin, which, as I understand, was of sufficient potency to kill 12,000 people.